freestyle. From the cursed tombs of cinema, this is the Uncut Gems podcast, a weekly show where we talk about movies nobody else wants to talk about. This is episode number 12, and my name's Jakob.
My name's Carson.
My name's Nick.
And I'm Alina.
Yeah, hi. So, thanks for tuning into our show. Glad to have all of you with us. We have some two returning hosts with us today. It's all going to be great. So before we actually get into the meat and potatoes of what we're going to be talking about, I'm sorry, Alina, I know you're vegan. So it's just that before we get into the soy, meat and potato, never mind. Corn, never mind.
Okay. Tofu, tofu is right there.
Tofu, before we get into the tofu and potatoes.
I got a tofurkey.
Anyway, into the salad of today's topic. Anyway, moving on. A few housekeeping things I wanted to kind of bring to the table. First, I think I might as well start with this first. We got our first, call it listener feedback through email. Actually, I got three emails from this person. So we've got ourselves, I think we've got ourselves a fan. So that's great. So that means we're getting places. We've got some feedback from a listener named Randy, who's he sent me, I think, a grand total of three or four emails. We've kind of just emailed for a bit, and then he's agreed to kind of just let some of these comments kind of just be aired on the air. So that's fine. So, you know, he really loves the show. He really likes how we're, you know, like trying to be serious, but we're not really serious all the time. So it's, you know, it's great. So he also, you know, I think he's going to reach out to you, Carson, at some point, because he said he would, because I also shared the Clappers sort of Clappercast's new email address that, you know, you've set up, because he also kind of just emailed feedback to me about the latest, I think it was the MonsterVerse episode of Clappercast. We should totally listen to Clappercast at Clapper Podcast on Twitter. Totally do it. Where he's basically praising you as like you're super professional and whatever. So and he's greatly impressed with your hosting skills, Carson. So, you know, thumbs up and high five. Anyway, so but he also had a few comments that kind of relate to. I think one of them relates to Never Let Me Go, and maybe I thought maybe I'll just throw it on to you guys to maybe discuss before we even start. So this episode is going to be long. Let's not kid ourselves. So we might as well make it a bit longer. Who cares? He emailed, well, so I'll read it out. So he says, "Well, Never Let Me Go, fantastic film, a sleeper classic. I don't totally hold it on the same pedestal as you, Jakob, but I wonder if I would upon a second viewing." What he says is, "I wish I knew specifics of decision making that went to the marketing of it. I suppose whatever its fate, $15 million was never too big a risk. If it were to make its budget back during the theatrical release, second run markets, yada yada yada, it could likely get it or to break even now." And he's like, so he's basically just, "It seems unlikely that Never Let Me Go ever recouped its budget, but it was probably a reasonable gambit considering the reasonable budget and potential for art house or award season breakouts." I suppose this is like, let's just throw it out to you guys. I think that there's a sort of question hidden in there, whether you think this was ever supposed to make money, or why did it not make money? And then what would you do to make it make money? Because he's also commenting on, well, from a marketing team's perspective, this was a tough sell because it kind of is like a period piece orphanage film and a coming age of age romance and a dystopian sort of sci-fi all sort of packed in one film. So it's very difficult to market it to any sort of particular demographic. So if you have any sort of comments on this, now is your time.
Yeah, just like, I still remember, I mentioned it in the episode, but I remember it being marketed, at least in Italy, as a proper thriller. Like, there was an underlying mystery, there was tension. That's the way it was marketed. So I can see people, even the few that went in the opening week, I'd say, not really creating positive word of mouth if they had those expectations going in. So I think definitely that. And also the like, I don't know if they sent it to multiple festivals and didn't get positive feedback, but I think sending it to like bigger, more acclaimed festivals like a Venice or a Toronto could have kind of launched it a bit more than, I don't remember, was it like New York or something like that? Just one or two festivals it did. I don't think they even knew what they had. That's my idea. They didn't know the uncut gem that they had on their hands. So, yeah.
Alina, do you have any thoughts on this? Or?
Well, I didn't know that it was a movie until we talked about it on the podcast. I don't know how it was marketed back in the day. I was like, I think I was like 13 when it came out. So I had no idea. This is not like a movie I would have watched at 13. I don't know what, even just like after watching the movie, I don't know how you would market it. Cause like based on the pictures I saw from the movie, I thought it was a coming of age movie until I started watching it. And I was like, holy shit, this is sci-fi.
Yeah. Carson, have you seen this already or are you still?
No, it's on my endless watch list. I have so much to catch up on with so much, but it's on the watch list.
Okay, so I'll try not to spoil it for you. But no, I was kind of thinking maybe you can chime in on this. Nicola, maybe you have some thoughts on this. I kind of have a feeling that this was never intended to make money in the first place anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, this is kind of one of those sort of festival films that are kind of, okay, well, this is how we're spending 15 million bucks and we're not really looking forward to making it back anyway because, you know, like our big tentpole blockbusters are making... making money for us so we can actually spend money on like artistically sort of driven projects, so no one gives a shit if it makes money or not. I suppose they give a shit whether it makes money or not, but I don't think anyone would cry.
And it helped to launch some careers of like Carey Mulligan and Andrew Garfield, who were starting to pop up here and there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if it was Carey Mulligan's sort of first role, because was she in, like,
An Education.
Oh, yeah, An Education. Was she in My... No, that was Michelle Williams in My Week with Marilyn.
Wasn't she in Pride and Prejudice, maybe?
Possibly, yeah.
I feel like everyone was in that movie.
Yeah, I think she was one of the sisters.
Oh, okay.
Of Keira Knightley.
Yeah, so this was kind of like, I don't know, like, yeah, it was a kind of nice launching pad for a few... young talented people. And he by the way, also Randy goes, you know, for a full on paragraph on about how he likes Mark Romanek. So I guess Nicola, you have something, you know, to high five him on.
The new film is coming back finally.
He's coming back to feature filmmaking. So, you know, yeah, he did mention that, you know, he was really a fan of 1 hour photo. I'm not sure if I was a fan of 1 hour photo. I should probably rewatch it because it's been a while, but it was in this sort of period where Robin Williams had this sort of brief sort of stint with being a villain or cast as a villain, like in Insomnia and 1 hour photo. And I can't remember what else. Randy also sent us another email about Congo, and he's also on Team Carson I quote, "I'm with Carson on this being junk, although it never features shoddy craftsmanship so much as a number of bad decisions. The production really needed someone to screen suggestions and serve as a sober second thought as far as so bad it's good experiences. The Island of Dr. Moreau was my fun nightmare." So, yeah.
Randy's a smart man.
Well,
smart.
Yeah. I mean, you know, clearly he's on Team Carson, and Carson's like, well, whatever, yeah. No, and he also has a few comments on, like, this was kind of like on the wave of, like, weird book adaptations by, like, Tom Clancy and, what's his face, John Grisham and Michael Crichton were all on this sort of era of Indecent Proposal, The Firm, and then apparently it was, because I can't remember, because I was, I don't know, in my let's just say teenage years, so that was marketed hard on adventure, so it was kind of like this sort of like post Jurassic Park / Indiana Jones sort of film. So yeah, anyway, so we've got ourselves a devoted listener, so, you know, shout out to Randy is an absolute legend. So, you know, hopefully you're listening to this, so, you know, send us another email. Like, I love reading emails from Randy. This is amazing. So that's one piece of housekeeping news. Another one that I wanted to bring to your attention is possibly a little bit of a fallout or a follow-up from our previous episode on Bringing Out the Dead, which, if you listen to it, then you'll know that, you know, it kind of started nice and then it kind of went off the rails and then kind of just clearly sort of... let's just say it clearly just illustrated that there is a need in our little community of film lovers. Then, you know, like, we're doing this together. There is a need to actually talk about other things than just this, what we're doing here, and then on Clappercast, I suppose, as well. So the idea surfaced for doing sort of premium episodes that we're not really sure exactly yet how this will be launched, potentially as a Patreon subscription sort of service of description. But the idea would be to kind of do, say, a monthly sort of episode that's kind of just unrelated to what we do, and possibly sort of centered around a particular topic that, let's just call it a hot topic. Okay, well, we'd just be going nuts about it for 2 or 3 hours at a time, and then people can listen to it if they pay a dollar or something stupid like this. So yeah, so the idea is to figure it out now and hopefully launch it in May. So now it's in public domain, so now I have to make it happen. So yeah, so there it is. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, guys, because I think, I don't know if Alina and Nico, because I know Carson knows, but yeah, yeah.
I saw it in the chat, and I think it's a good idea because we often get off topic on certain things. Clapper yeah. tangents, as we call them right now.
Yeah. No, I mean the fact that we get off topic so often is probably also my fault, because like I'm really shit at moderating things and telling people to kind of like no you can't do this, like you need to stop right now, and then you know.
Yeah, it happens on Clappercast too. Don't worry about it, Jakob.
Yeah, so okay, so let's just say that this is these are the two items of housekeeping sort of news that I wanted to kind of bring to the table. So yeah. Back to the show. Welcome to the Uncut Gems podcast. This is episode number 12, and we're doing this. So last week we spoke at length, really, about Bringing Out the Dead, and dare I say, we had, at least as far as the actual film goes, one of the deepest and sort of most compelling conversations yet on the show. This was something really special, I think. Like we did accomplish something there, I think. Where it eventually went is a whole different matter, as I mentioned just now. You know, shout out to Dr. Filibuster himself, Jack Looksharp. follow this guy, he's amazing. But the episode is well worth visiting, so make sure you do that when you have a minute. However, today we are talking about two, possibly maybe three, depends. I don't know, it all depends on Alina, really.
Yeah.
Three films. And then we're doing this because it's a bit of a special occasion. And now I think, may I say this? I think I can. We're doing this because Alina, I think, had her birthday right now, a few days ago.
The day it drops, it's my birthday.
Oh, okay. So
like right now when we're recording, it's a week away.
Okay. So as you're listening to this, Alina's going to be celebrating her birthday. And I think some of her favorite films, or I don't know if it's guilty pleasure films or there's nothing guilty about the pleasure, the Mummy films from like the late 90s and early 2000s. So we're doing them. So we're going to be talking about the 1999 Mummy and the sequel, possibly the second sequel. So yeah, so let's kick off with the 1999 Stephen Sommers directed film called The Mummy.
I will give you £100 to save this man's life.
Madam, I would pay £100 just to see him hanged.
£200.
Proceed.
£300.
Any last request, pig?
Yeah, loosen the knot and let me go.
Yeah, man. Of course we don't let him go. Yeah, but that.
£500.
Walk off, Andak.
And what else? I'm a very lonely man.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Dashing legionnaire Rick O'Connell, that's played by Brendan Fraser, stumbles upon the hidden ruins of Hamunaptra while in the midst of a battle to claim the area in 1920s Egypt. It has been over 3,000 years since former high priest Imhotep suffered a fate worse than death as a punishment for a forbidden love, along with a curse that guarantees eternal doom upon the world if he is ever awoken. So as you may imagine, he is awoken, and then, you know, the adventure goes from there. So I'll do a little bit of a preamble. So if you, the idea of, you probably know if you're listening to this, that the 1999 Mummy was, let's just call it a loose remake of the 1932 Mummy with Boris Karloff. I think it was directed by Karl Freund, something like that. Anyway, but it was one of the sort of early Universal Monsters movies. And then the idea of remaking this dates back to like the early 90s. And if I remember correctly, there's quite a lot of people that have been attached to the idea of making this as this idea evolved. And I think it was originally pitched to Clive Barker to direct this. So you can imagine where this would have gone, because, you know, I think he's the sort of mastermind behind the Hellraiser films. And then Joe Dante had a go at pitching how he would like to make this work. Then George Romero wanted to make The Mummy as a sort of a zombie style Night of the Living Dead sort of film. And then was pitched to Wes Craven, who said, fuck off, not doing it. And then eventually the guy called Stephen Sommers, who I think he was at the time mostly associated with Disney. He directed the Jungle Book in 1993 or 4 with Jason Scott Lee. Which is a terrible, terrible movie, by the way. I mean, if you're a 10-year-old boy or something like this, it's probably amazing. But yeah. But anyway, so he pitched this as this sort of loose remake of the original film with this sort of swashbuckling sort of adventure in the style of Indiana Jones. And this thing took off. And it was released in 1999. It made absolute crap ton of money at the box office. The critics were kind of like, I don't know. Apparently, well, although Roger Ebert said, I can't possibly hate it because it's kind of like, I'm very pleased by watching this, but I can't remember a single thing about it in his review. So, you know, so take it or leave it. However, it was successful enough that it sparked, I don't know, a whole franchise around this, you know, and then we'll get to it later. And then I think it also kind of was instrumental in sort of inspiring things like the Pirates of the Caribbean and films like that. So, yeah. However, as blockbusters go, it was quickly, I want to say, overshadowed by, say, more successful films. And it was, unluckily enough, released in 1999, which was the year of The Matrix and the year of, I think, The Phantom Menace. So it's, I don't want to say it's forgotten, but it's kind of orphaned. So people know it's there, but no one kind of gives it the credit or the respect it possibly deserves. So the question is that I'm throwing out to you in terms of the general impressions, does The Mummy deserve to be reappraised? Does The Mummy hold up as a blockbuster of its time? Is it timeless? Is it not timeless? Is it so bad it's good? Is it good? Or is it just bad? So the floor is yours. And then might as well kick off with the birthday girl herself, Alina. Why don't you, lead the way?
Yeah, so if you're listening to this on April 16th, right when it drops, I am 24 today. It's disgusting, but whatever. I think this episode stemmed from when we were doing like the Convoy podcast, and we like joked about doing like Mamma Mia for Carson's birthday next year. And I was like, well, if Carson gets a birthday podcast, I want a birthday podcast because that's not fair. And mine's in April, it's first. So I was like, we have to do the Mummy movies because I fucking love the Mummy movies. Like for me, The Mummy came out when I was 2, so obviously I did not see it in theaters. I don't know when I saw it for the first time, because The Mummy and The Mummy Returns have been like one of those movies that have always been like a constant in my life. These two movies are my mom's favorite movies, and that's why I love them so much, because like for like every single family movie night, this woman would pitch, let's watch The Mummy or let's watch Pirates of the Caribbean. Those were her only two options. So I've seen both of these like franchises too many times to count, but like The Mummy, I just like, is so beloved to us as a family. Oh, I just love it so much. Like, it's the reason I'm a history major. I got like super into like Egyptian history and mythology and ancient history because of these movies. Like, I fucking became a history major over this like perfect blockbuster action movie from 1999. That's like so insane how much this like movie means to me. So I hope you guys like it at least half as much as I do.
I'll jump in, I guess. The 1932 Mummy is one of my favorite films of all time. I love that film with a passion. The sequels from like the direct Universal Monsters like universe, some of my least favorite films of all time. So after those films, I've not checked out any other Mummy film except for 2017 or whatever that one is, and I hated it. So I've never checked out this film before this podcast, and I started watching this, and for the first like 10-15 minutes, I was like, oh no, I'm gonna have to like word this to where like, oh Alina, I'm sorry. But then you get to the boat scene, and from the boat scene on, this is a wildly fun time. I love this movie. I had so much fun with it. It has some of the best like one-liners and characters that are just like, it's just so fucking fun. I'll say the horror elements, you know, I could definitely could leave them. The mummy itself looks a little, you know, iffy to, you know, 1999. It is what it is. But like, this is fun. This is very reminiscent of like when I first watched the first Indiana Jones. Yes, there are flaws. Yes, it might not be like the perfect film, but it is such a blast. I could see this like being a film I turn on any day of the week and I have a great time with. It does take that little, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes to really, you know, pick up and get going. Once it does, though, I had a lot of fun with this film. I greatly enjoyed it.
My history with this film is actually pretty close to that of Alina. This was a pure childhood classic. And when I say childhood, I first saw this when I was 3 or 4 years old, because my parents were gangsters and showed me so many movies that I shouldn't be watching that young. And it's literally been a constant throughout my life. I must have seen the first one like 15 times, maybe, over the years. It's literally the kind of film that we just get together to watch sometimes. You can say, yeah, let's just watch The Mummy, because why not? It's literally the only film in our collection for which we have like 3 different versions of the DVD. It's like the special edition and the collector's edition and the normal one. And it's insane. And it's kind of like Carson said, it's just the element of adventure in it. It's so fun, so fun. It's such an exciting film. It's 2 hours long. Once it starts, it picks up the pace. It never lets go. And actually, I when I was younger, it scared the crap out of me. And rewatching it now, the horror element definitely hasn't aged that well. Or it's not that effective anymore. But I do still think it's one of my favorite action horror films, which is a subgenre I'm very fond of. I don't know. It's kind of a perfect storm as far as just pure blockbuster entertainment goes. Like, it could have gone so badly, and instead it's just everyone is at their peak, especially Brendan Fraser, Rachel Weisz. It's a good film.
Wow. Okay. How do I break this to you? In a polite way. No, okay. Well, I'll put it this way. First, okay, I don't have a nostalgic connection to this film. I didn't see it in the cinema, and I was old enough to see it in the cinema, I think, because I would have been 15, I think, at the time. But I kind of didn't see it in the cinema. I saw it on home video at the time. And I don't remember too much about it, so I don't think it stayed with me. I think that I was more sort of, this would have been the time that I would have been more at home watching The Matrix and The Phantom Menace, I think. So it kind of just flew under my radar. So this makes it a perfect sort of episode of the show, because it kind of just, at least from my perspective. Now, before I actually finish my initial impressions, I want to, before I forget, Carson, is this your Congo?
Like, no, because this movie's good.
Like, no, it's not.
This is not an ironic, like, I don't ironically like the film. I just think it's like genuinely fun and good.
I mean, okay, the first one, I think, okay, the first one is the best of the lot. I'll put it this way already, so spoiler alert. Yeah, sure.
You just said we weren't going to talk about the entire franchise.
No, but I'll put it this way. When I watch this now, I could honestly just log it on Letterboxd as the first time watch, because I remember absolutely zero things about it, apart from one or two things that kind of have become memes, sort of, like the sort of the sandstorm sort of image is kind of like embedded in popular culture for some reason, and few faces that Imhotep makes kind of have entered the sort of meme sphere for some reason. Anyway, I do like about this, I would say I do like its energy, which I think is kind of borrowed from like the 1930s cinema. And I wanted to say that there's one scene that kind of just sells me on the film. If you had to sell me on this film, you need to show me the scene where Brendan Fraser's packing a suitcase and Rachel Weisz is unpacking the suitcase. This is literally like a screwball comedy from 1934, and you could imagine young Cary Grant and young Katharine Hepburn doing this, and they're bickering, and it's kind of, and they have good chemistry. And now I'm just thinking, okay, more of this, please, right? The horror elements I can take or leave. Special effects, we'll get to it. I mean, I might as well just say that, you know, 1999 was a time where I think CGI effects were kind of, I don't want to say they were coming to its own, but they were kind of becoming a little bit more prevalent in, but they were not good enough yet. As in, like, it's not like early 90s in like T2 where, or Jurassic Park or something like this, where they were just like gently peppered in. No, people were saying, like, we can make shit happen with CGI, and then this does not age well in this regard. So it kind of looks to me like a teenager figuring out that they can grow facial hair, and they think, oh, this looks good on me. And then 20 years later, they'll look back at their photographs and say, fucking hell, I could not grow a beard. Someone should have stopped me. Like, so the sort of CGI effects of in the first film, I think limited as they are, they're kind of dated a little bit. However, there's a lot of practical things that I kind of like. So the boat, sort of, there's a lot of sort of physical set pieces that I can latch onto. So like the boat and the sort of the Americans being a little bit ridiculous because they're shooting at everything and they're yee-hawing all over the shop. It's pretty great. So I kind of like the energy, but the sort of central intrigue. So Imhotep as a villain, I could not buy. I'm sorry. He's kind of like meh. And the only thing I could, I don't know, I couldn't buy into this sort of tragic love story that he has with this lady in the beginning. So it's kind of like weird. So these are kind of like my initial impressions that I kind of just, I like the chemistry, and I like the fact that it's kind of borrowing left, right, and center from Indiana Jones. And I have a thing that each one of these Mummy movies borrows a little bit from a different Indiana Jones movie. And I don't know what you guys think, but I have a thing that this one borrows the heaviest from Temple of Doom. Of all things, only Rachel Weisz is not as moany as Kate Capshaw. So there it is. And she's a librarian, and she's all, yeah, but anyway. So these are my initial impressions. I honestly don't know where to go with this, because it's kind of, I think it's like a kitchen sink sort of film that you can have a talk about. How it relates to the original, how it, I don't know, relates to special effects and whatever. So I don't know where you want to go with this.
Jacob, how do you watch this film and you're like, it's bad, right? Like, it's not good. It's not fun.
No,
and then you watch Congo and you're like, well, actually though, maybe it is fun. And maybe like I can overlook how like shit the film is.
I've been having the same thoughts. I was like, how can I explain myself to Carson that I'm not having this much fun with this as I had with Congo. And then the answer is this film's, let's just say, not self-aware enough. It's kind of just, it wants to be this sort of swashbuckling sort of serious thing, and it's not like tongue-in-cheek enough, although it is slightly tongue-in-cheek, and I kind of do appreciate it for it. It's not like I hate this. It's, you know, it's all right for me. However, yeah, you'd have to kind of tell me more why I should love this, because holy shit, I don't know why I should.
I appreciate that this won't do anything for the audience, but especially with your camera, with how it is right now, with like the light shooting up, it looks like a horror film. I think it might just be because you're genuinely crazy. I think you just kind of look like you're gonna kill people.
Hold on 2 seconds. I need to put, because, you know, hold on, and to switch some lights on, because like the sun's just set and
just went away pretty quickly.
hold on.
The setup is crumbling.
There we are.
Okay, now you just look like you're not going to kill me. That's good.
Goes on the bingo card as well. Right? My microphone just fell again. Is it better now?
Yeah.
Not maybe. No. No, I mean, I don't know. Alina, tell me why I should love this.
Well, my love for these movies definitely come from childhood nostalgia, but I just like really like the adventure story and all the elements that are like in it. I think the thing that sticks out the most to me is just like the romance. Like as I was watching, we watched it last night, and like that was the first time I've like seen it in like 3-ish years, which is surprising. I thought I would have watched it a couple more times since then, but like as like a child and like teenager, I've probably seen these at least 50 times because my mom is just like that psycho with recommending The Mummy every week. If I had Letterboxd as a child, I wish I like knew how many times I've actually seen this movie because it's too many. Like as I was watching it last night and like really trying to like observe everything and think like now that I actually like think of like films more than just like watching it, I just love the story between like Rick and Evie. I just fucking love them as like a couple. They're so like they have with each other, the way they like slowly fall in love with each other. That like scene of them when like Jonathan is like passed out drunk and they're like drunk around the campfire together, and Evie is just like talking about how she's like so excited to be here and like a librarian. You can just like see Rick slowly falling in love with her, and every time they're running away together he grabs Evie's hand. I fucking love Brendan Fraser so much. I love Rick O'Connell so much. I love Evie. I love Jonathan. I love the characters in this movie.
I mean, let's specify. You love Brendan Fraser in 1999 because, you know, have you seen what he looks like now?
Yes. He's making a great comeback and I'm proud of him.
I do appreciate it. This is, I mean, at least the way I see it is Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz's character are clearly sort of trying to kind of capitalize on the sort of chemistry that, say, like Harrison Ford and Karen Allen had in Raiders or something like this. They're kind of bickering. They all know their shit. They're experts in their field, by the way. So it's kind of like it's one of the things that I kind of just have a, this is where I have a little bit of a problem with the film, is that everyone's kind of in the same headspace, as in there's no one for me to latch onto, as in like there's no sort of like outsider in. Like the closest would be Rick's character because he's kind of like, oh, like there's, I don't know, there's like mummies and shit, like I don't know. But then it's the only film I can latch on to him, because later on he's everyone's kind of experts in their field and they're all kind of telling me what I should be watching. But I don't know, I have a feeling that they don't have flaws. Like Indiana Jones was afraid of snakes, and then like I don't know, like, why should I fear for Brendan Fraser? He's like indestructible in nearly, and Rachel Weisz is just the smartest person in the world as well. Like I don't, yeah. So it's kind of like one of those things that I'd like them to have some flaws for me to kind of just, I don't know, say, like, oh my goodness, they're gonna, I don't know, just abuse the flaw, and then they'll have to, I don't know, do something about it and just rescue someone. But this doesn't really happen.
Well, I think Evie has like a lot of hubris, because like at least in this movie, the whole thing about wanting to go to Hamanachar and find the Book of the Dead and all these things is she wants to prove herself. Like there's that scene at the beginning when she's like being a little librarian with that curator guy. I don't know any of the side characters' names, honestly, even though I've seen this movie 50 times, because they don't like say other people's names. Like the Magi warrior, I love him. I think he's like so hot and sexy. No idea what his name is, even though I've seen this
the face tattoo person.
Yeah. Freaking love him. Don't know his name. Anyway.
Same thing. It's a face tattoo person for me.
Yeah. So like in the library, and she like knocks everything, all the like bookshelves down. And like the guy comes in, he's like ridiculing her or whatever. And he's like, well, you're only here because your parents are like huge patrons of the museum and whatever. And like, so when they get to Hamanachra and everyone is like warning Evie, like, you shouldn't read this, you shouldn't do this, you're gonna like wake up the mummy. And she's like, she just wants to prove herself. And I think like that is her weakness, at least with Evie. I agree that like Rick doesn't really have a lot other than like he wants to protect Evie. Yeah.
So that doesn't help.
Yeah, I think what I really like about the film and about the characters, they are not all that flawed. That's true. But there's so many wonderful, wonderful little character moments and small interactions. I would even say, just to make it a bit more topical, I would even say this is almost where, well, the Indiana Jones films were already a bit like that small, small, small elements of humor. This is when kind of the Marvel formula of like quips and wittiness, something that we saw in the Pirates of the Caribbean, I think it really started with this film. And it just works. I think it's endlessly endearing. Like every single time I watch this, I'm always with a smile on my face. I know exactly what the punchlines are going to be. But there's just so many moments. The physical gags as well are just actually effective. Like you said, very much like a 1930s rom-com film. And that's what makes the film for me. Because, yeah, I do think Imhotep, like, I like his design a lot. The fact that it's not just the mummy. It's not like the fully fledged, I don't know, like a Boris Karloff or a Christopher Lee. But he has to regenerate throughout the film. He bits and pieces of his body come back as he's eating the lost souls that he's opened his chest.
In the original The Mummy, he's only the mummy in like the first act, if I remember correctly. I didn't
in the first jump scare.
But then he's just Boris Karloff.
Yeah.
Because Carson, that's your favorite film of all time. We should remember this, because I've seen this like 5 years
ago. Calm down, not my favorite film of all time, but yeah.
Sorry, second favorite.
You're not wrong. Maybe number three.
Mamiya 2,
Mamiya 1, you know.
and then The Mummy, and then Bride of Frankenstein.
First Reformed somewhere in there, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I kind of see that this is like a 90s sort of, as well. Like, I appreciate this sort of concept of building the villain as a let's make him like this mummy who's kind of just rebuilds himself as he eats people's souls or life essence or whatever. But he just I have a feeling that this is where I don't know if it was a practical effect. I think I'm more sort of endeared towards, because the dated practical effects I find cute. And maybe this will be an interesting topic, I think, for now, because there is a, let's just call it the generation gap between us, because I'm a millennial, you guys are Gen Zs, right? so you're steeped in a different sort of, like, you grew up with CGI effects in films. So from day one, like, I had to kind of undergo a transition as I was growing up, because the CGI was taking hold as I was kind of getting more aware of what cinema was. So to me, it's kind of like the CGI is still the new kid on the block, as opposed to, and then the practical effects are kind of things that are kind of more natural to me. So maybe that's also part of the reason where this film kind of desperately wants to capitalize on the effects that they didn't have the capacity to use the way we can use them now, that they kind of still, that they look quote unquote photorealistic, because it kind of looks a little bit, I don't know, a little bit kind of just cheap and it doesn't age very well, at least they're sort of late 90s. So is that what it is, let me rephrase this. Do you notice that the CGI effects are kind of shit?
I was going to say no, actually. Outside of like when Imhotep awakens and in his first form, which is kind of almost entirely CGI, that looks off with the lighting. But other than that, I think everything else aged pretty well. I noticed a lot of blending in. The future films in the franchise have like so much like just CGI set pieces. Well, this one still has a very practical feel to it, in my opinion. Even watching it, like, we rented the 4K version of the Blu-ray, and it still looked pretty solid for most of the film.
I mean, ironically enough, I would agree that the first one does the best job compositing these effects.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Even though I think it costs the least to make, it's bizarre to me. But apparently, I'm not sure if the second and the third one were, but this one was ILM that was in charge of CGI.
I think the second one also adds ILM.
So yeah, but to me, I can disregard the CGI in the first one, because there is this sort of Indiana Jones swashbuckling sort of adventure that kind of just sells me on this enough, even though I kind of just have trouble sort of latching onto the characters. But the characters have enough chemistry between them to kind of just, I can say, yeah, they're trying to be a bit of a sweeping drama in place. But I have a feeling that this is also Jerry Goldsmith was kind of asked to just make the sort of score a little bit almost too epic for its own good. But it kind of works. I mean, I don't... It's old enough to, I don't know how to phrase this. I don't have a nostalgic connection to it, and I can't see this the way you see it, but I understand why you would see it the way you see it. Does it make any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't wait till we get to Night at the Museum 2. that's gonna be a good episode. Oh, yeah,
we're doing this. Oh my goodness. Is this
the Night at the Museum movies are another franchise that heavily contributed to me becoming a history major. So just saying.
See, I think how you feel about this film is how I feel about like number two specifically in that franchise. But we'll get there in like December or whatever.
No, but then the history majors before you get on Carson, I'm just sorry. I'm This is not the first time this happened, right? Like, because I think Raiders did this for many people in the 80s. Yeah, so you
glorified the archaeologists.
So it kind of, I don't know, it kind of just lives in the sort of legacy of that. So I kind of appreciate that, especially if it did work on you this way. You know, all power to you. You know, come on.
Yeah, I didn't watch Indiana Jones as like a little kid. I watched it for the first time when I was like a teenager. So I guess that's why like The Mummy sticks out more to me than Indiana Jones. But like, yeah, I wanted to be like an archaeologist because of this movie. And I didn't, I realized like now it's like not 1930s Egypt anymore. And there's like a lot of like science and math required now. And I was like, I can't do that. I hate it. I would love to be like an imperializing British man in the 1930s unearthing tombs. Like, career.
Would you become the archaeologist to get hired by the British Museum and then secretly give the shit back?
Yeah, I would do that.
Yeah. Carson, you wanted to jump in. Sorry.
I think this film does bite off more than it can chew, definitely. Like, I think the horror elements, the more serious elements can go. If this was like fully kind of camp comedy, fun one-liners, yeah, it'd be like a masterpiece. As is, I can only give it 3.5 stars on Letterboxd, and it's like a fun experience. But like, yeah, it does try to be a little bit too serious, a little too much, you know.
I mean, even in the sort of unserious moments, I kind of like them. But then again, they kind of come out of nowhere as though they were kind of... I have a feeling that the script was kind of half written on the set. Like, there's one moment where I think they lock Rachel Weisz in a hotel room, and then... they have to scare a guy away, and they find a cat. Just there's a big massive fight scene, and there's a cat on the sofa. I'm like, do they not own cats? Like, if there was a fight scene going on, the cat will be under the sofa, pretending it's not there, right? First and foremost. But they pick up the cat and they realize, oh yeah, well, Egyptians are afraid of cats, so let's at them, right? But it comes out of nowhere because it's just not foreshadowed in any way. It's kind of like, yeah, there's this. It's just kind of like, I don't know. There's quite a few like little sort of things in there that are kind of, I think, sprinkled in without much sort of thought.
The cat part is weird because don't Egyptians worship cats?
Yeah, why? But then again, like, this is, yeah.
I think that's explained, but I can't remember why.
Yeah, they like, say it's... Like,
it's specifically Imhotep that's afraid of cats.
Because they're the guardians of the underworld, something like that. That's say. Yeah, so it reminds him of that.
Yeah, but they
scares him off.
But they kind of explain it afterwards, don't they? As opposed to like,
if they... right after the first cat scene.
But then I don't know. I would appreciate it more if this was kind of, I don't know, woven in the beginning of the film and got just capitalized. Oh yeah, right. They mentioned like in the sort of like cats are this or whatever. Even if it was like a blatant exposition, I'd probably bought it better than this. But yeah, I don't know. I can see how it's like the Indiana Jones of its time, and I can appreciate it even a little bit more based on how much of an effect it has on people, say your age. But yeah, holy shit! This like an Imhotep, like you'd have to sell me on this because this guy as an actor is kind of like a really meh.
No, not Per Arnold Vosloo.
He speaks a language that I'm not even sure if it's a real language, by the way. He just says things and people kind of blatant, like randomly understand him. And then, it's
because Evie can speak ancient Egyptian. Of course she does. She knows what it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly.
But she can.
Yeah. And he's just like, oh, yeah, because of course they left audible sort of audiobooks or whatever. Yeah. So
I like Imhotep as a villain. I always I always felt like bad for him when I was growing up because like I knew he was like the bad guy, but like the reason he's doing all this stuff is because he wants to be with the love of his life. He wants to be with Anuk and Amun. And I always my mom and I would always say like, why can't they just be together? Like, why does he have to just like take over this whole fucking world? They can just bring her back from the dead and just like chill off somewhere in the desert. Like, you don't need to be running around being an evil ass mummy. It's just like, I feel bad for him that he just wants to be with his girl.
I suppose this works because yeah. it's supposed to be a tragic villain, no?
Mm-hmm. Rewatching it, one thing that stood out to me, it's closer to almost a gothic Dracula-esque villain. Even just the scene that we mentioned when he's sneaking into the room of Rachel Weisz, of Evie, and just getting close to bed and kissing her, that just instantly brought back images of like the Francis Ford Coppola, Dracula, and just all of those very gothic figures. And yeah, it's the tragedy of it. It's all about love and bringing back the woman he loved. So yeah, it's. I don't know. I think it's good enough. Like the villain, it's good enough. It's not the most like complicated nemesis for these characters. But it fits. Yeah. There's enough tension as well because there's a sense of like the impending doom. Even if some things are questionable, like it seems like the whole world is going to shit and blood's everywhere. And then like two scenes later, it's sunny and it's fine. Like, oh yeah, that happened and someone cleaned it up. Yeah, there's some weird bits like that. But yeah, I like that.
It doesn't need to be anything like big or complicated. Like you said it perfectly. It fits. It fits what the movie's going for. Sure, like if you compare it to like any other villain, yeah, it's not great, but like it's not trying to be. Like it's not that serious of a film.
I get it. I mean, it fits, but then again, what's the stake of the film? Where's the urgency?
The end of the world.
They're fighting a fucking mummy who's risen from the dead.
Well, yeah, but then okay.
And he wants to turn Evie into his body for an extended movie to come back.
What are the stakes? It's a silly fun film like about a group of people in fucking Egypt. Like who cares what the stakes are? Who cares what their faults are? It's not supposed to be this like gripping drama.
You sound like me on the Congo episode. Great. but I get this. But then personal, like I don't care about the end of the world. Like this because this is very in dramatic terms, you can latch on to better to a single character's drama than like the entire world coming to an end because it's immaterial. Like you can't visualize this. If there is a loved one whose life is at stake, you resonate better with something like this. Now,
but Evie's life is at stake.
Yeah, for like 5 minutes.
No, for the entire freaking movie.
And then Brendan Fraser comes in with an axe, and then she's free, and then she's free to read Egyptian out loud at her leisure, which is brilliant, by the way. But you know, but
for the entire movie, he's like Imhotep is like going after her.
Well, yeah. So I mean, that's I don't know. I kind of what I'm trying to say is I would like this to be more focused around this instead of trying to sell me on 1999 special effects. If that makes any sense.
I'm gonna I know we said we weren't going to mention it this early on. It feels like you're talking about The Mummy Returns right now.
I mean,
agree more.
I'll be honest with you. At this point, I'm trying to stay focused on the first one because they're now all three blending into one in my head.
It's a nightmare.
No, because I've watched them in such a close succession, and I'm like, I'm trying to say Scorpion King's in the second one. Scorpion King is in the second one, because that's kind of like my and the third one's about China. Third one's about China. So you know, it's kind of like
keeping them separated.
Yeah, the first one and the second one kind of tend to. I need to think like for a second or two to remember which scenes from the first and from the second because they do callbacks all throughout the series around certain scenes.
Jacob, are you a fan of the first Indiana Jones?
Yeah.
What is what you're describing about some you hate, you also look at Indiana Jones and like you could have the same issues, I feel. But
mm-hmm. But see, this is for me, Indiana Jones is for me what Mummy is for Alina. So you know it's ineffable. So as in, you know, you can I have a nostalgic connection to it because I saw it when I was very young. Almost dangerously too young. But
same.
Yeah, so it's one of those, if you saw Mummy, I can see this. If you saw Mummy ahead of Raiders of the Lost Ark, I could see how you imprinted on this and this is your film now, right? But then you know, like I've my heart is taken by Harrison Ford. So yeah, I mean, it's not, like, I'm not trying to say that the film's bad. The second and the third one are a separate conversation. But, you know, I can see how it's playful and it's trying to do certain things that have not been done since the 80s. Because when was the fourth Indiana Jones, by the way?
2008. Fourth?
Yeah. So it's kind of like... 2008, it's yeah. kind of blazed the trail for even the fourth Indiana Jones, especially the second Mummy, I think, has a few things that were kind of picked up by Spielberg in there. But I can see how it's kind of trying to revive the sort of thing that got forgotten for like a decade. But yeah, it's what I'm trying to say is I kind of missed out on this in the cinema. I didn't get to imprint on this, and now it's too late for me to kind of say, yeah, it's I can't see Carson. You'd have to forgive me. I can't say going stone cold fresh and say I'm having a blast with this because it's like not yeah.
It's not even that I like this film that much because like honestly I enjoy it. No, I had a blast. I enjoy it, but like I really don't have any stakes. Like you know, take it or leave it. I'm not very passionate about this film. But like I come on this podcast every fucking week, and every time I have an issue, you pick these stupid ass films like Congo, and I come on here after I watch these pieces of shit in my busy schedule because I like talking to you and I like talking to Alina and Nick and all of you, and I come on here. And I'm like, oh, it's horrible. And then you're like, Carson, you're such a party pooper. How could you not like Congo with a fucking sign languaging ape that drinks martinis? And it's like, we get to Mummy and you're like, well, I hate it. And for this reason, no, fuck off. Fuck off, no. Genuinely. If you cannot, if you're going to sit on here and be like, Carson, how dare you not like Congo? But then you're going to shit on Alina's birthday podcast. You're going to spend 20 so minutes rude. Bullshitting about Mummy. Fuck you, Jakob. Fuck you.
I mean, genuinely. I don't hate it. I just don't love it. And I don't know how to sell this to Alina, you know, because I'm so.
Listen, for how quotable this movie is alone, it is a 5-star fucking movie. When I was watching it last night, like Justin was in the room, but he wasn't like watching. He's never seen these movies before. So I'm very pissed off that he didn't watch them with me. He doesn't listen to this, so he's not going to hear that. But I hope he like knows how pissed off I am at him that he didn't watch these with me. But anyway, I would like talk along to like the movie every time there was like a quip, like what is a place like me doing in a girl like this, and like patience is a virtue, not right now it isn't. And Justin's like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, how do you know every single line in this movie? Because it's so good. They're just like great lines. It's
think about my children. I don't have, you don't have children. Well, one day I might. So good.
I'll be honest with you, I'm not saying anything because this is gonna sound rude. Because I'm gonna say it. I didn't remember a single one of those lines.
Trash.
No,
you're a bad just... person. You have bad taste.
I mean, that's very possible. but no, it's just I don't know. The screwball comedy bits do stuff for me, and I really like how they bicker. But I can't possibly like I appreciate the idea of I like how they bicker, but then just. Goes right in my eyes and out my asshole immediately. It's kind of like just like, yeah, there it is. Like, it's just very, like, I didn't retain much of this film for some reason, even though I like the, I feel like Roger Ebert, like when I read this review just before the episode, I'm like, yeah, I kind of understand. I like what I'm seeing. It's very pleasurable. Don't remember anything about it. It's, yeah, so I'm sorry. Happy birthday.
Savage comments.
I'm so sorry.
I would even add something that just makes me love this film so much in an entertaining way. This is one of the very, very, very rare blockbusters where I actually remember the side characters. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember the brother, Jonathan, who's a drunkard and fucks up every single time. I remember Benny, who is the backstabbing Judas, who keeps sniveling away, saving his life in some weird ass way.
Oh, Benny I like, yeah, okay. And there's the third one, who gets to show his willy.
Yes. And crashes his head after like scarabs enter his brain. I don't know, that's horrible. That's a scary scene. That's like watching it again.
I mean, yeah, it's surprisingly violent for what it is, by the way. Like, especially when you think about, like, for late 90s, I think people were kind of starting to be a bit more chilled out about violence in films. It kind of is trying to be violent, like the sort of the 80s sort of Indiana Jones films were. But there's not much blood because they kind of get away with this being like sand, or they just, I don't know, there's not much blood in there. But if you think about what's happening to these characters, there's people being beheaded or, so, you know, it's.
There's a guy without his eyes, like you can see his eyes
and the tongue.
Mm-hmm. And the tongue, yeah.
Yeah, like even the Americans are freaking memorable for me. Like when they popped up again, I was like, oh,
yeah. You.
I mean, the Americans are the most memorable to me at least.
Yeah, I love the scene of the like one guy and he's like more one of the like more nerdy Americans. And when like all the locusts came and he's just like covered in locusts and he's like, what have we done? I don't know, that always just stuck out to me. I like all the Americans.
I love how they have staged the shootout on a burning boat, and they think this is a good idea to barricade themselves and start and do a proper Wild West shootout.
Mm-hmm. just blowing.
It's just really
down.
Funny seeing cowboys in Egypt.
So see, Carson, I don't hate it. It's just you know. I remember things about it.
mm-hmm. But yeah, I also really like all the side characters, like. Benny, I like the scene when like Imhotep is confronting him for the first time and then he has all these fucking chains around his neck of like different religious symbols and he's like picking them up. That was amazing. Like every time, that is so good. And then when like he gets to like the Star of David and like Imhotep's like, oh, you're a slave. I see. And I'm like, oh, Benny, what a little backstabber that kid is.
The little moments, they make mm-hmm. the characters feel alive. You don't need that much exposition or anything. You see those little moments, like, yeah, I get who this guy is. You don't need anything more.
Yeah. Oh, yes. So I suppose, yeah, that's what it is. I mean, should we move on to the second one, or do you still have like stuff to say?
I'm ready to move on. Like, they kind of blend together, for sure.
Yeah, so because I kind of have a feeling that I'm invariably starting to kind of just merge certain aspects of the second one into what I'm thinking now, so I don't know, we might as well just move mm-hmm. on. So, yeah.
Especially since there's, like, a lot of callbacks to the first movie and the second one.
And I haven't... Yeah. Okay, well, we might as well get to it now as well. In the third one, there's also a few callbacks. Like, there's always...
Jesus.
No, there's because there's
oh yes,
there's one thing I remember the most is the in the first one you have the sort of sandstorm with the face, and then there's a wave with the face in the second one, and there's avalanche with a human person, sort of like human sort of silhouette in the third one. Mm. Yeah, so I have a thing like there. Oh, that would be cool. Let's do this. Like, and then the director is like, oh, totally. Yeah,
that's what we're like in the contract. We have to have one of those moments in every one of the films.
No, I have a feeling that this is a note made like left by like executive producers or someone like that. And yeah, so the 1999 The Mummy is kind of as you can see, if you're in the right sort of age range and it just touches you as in just the right time of your life, it can change your life. Happy birthday, Alina. And it was a reasonably successful thing in its own right, successful enough that the sequel came, 2 years later? And the second one was... I want to say this, it's kind of just tries to repeat what the first one did and makes a bit of a formula. So it kind of starts with the sort of like an sequence in the past where you get introduced to the Scorpion King and he's supposed to lead an army, and then we fast forward to the present and all of a sudden Evie and Rick is it 10 years after?
Yeah, because I think their son's 9.
So now they have a son. They have an established sort of relationship. They have a son and they all explore the world together, and then they stumble upon this sort of artifact that, you know, is supposed to resurrect the Scorpion King. And then yet again we find out that there's a cult trying to again resurrect Imhotep, because it kind of just and then things go from there, and then another adventure sort of ensues because Imhotep is going to be resurrected, and then you know the world's going to come to an end for one reason or another. So where do you guys stand on this? Alina, do you want to go first again? Happy birthday.
Yeah. So I acknowledge that The Mummy Returns is not as iconic as the first movie, but I still really love it. Like, as I was watching this again last night, I was realizing, okay, this is like not as amazing as I remember it to be, but it's still amazing. The thing I like the most about the second one is the women have a lot more to do. Like, Evie in the first movie is still like amazing and iconic, and she uses her like knowledge to like get every out of everything, but she has like a lot more like story, and the focus is like more on her rather than like the other characters. Like she's the main character in this movie, and like Onyx and Amun in the second one has a lot more to do as well, especially with like the girl who's like the reincarnated version of her. So I like it for that, because like I freaking love girls in the Mummy movies, like Evie and Onyx and Amun. I like them both, even though Onyx and Amun is kind of bad. I just freaking love them. I feel like the lines in this movie are not as iconic, but I respect this movie a lot because it really helped launch Dwayne The Rock Johnson's acting career, because it resulted in the Scorpion King spinoff, which we can talk about if you guys watched it, because I watched it this morning. Yeah, honestly, it's really blending with the first movie. I don't remember a lot what happens, even though I just watched it last night, because like it's so hard for me to distinguish like what is in one movie and what is in the other. Like I remember they have a child, and I don't really like their son, but like he gets kidnapped. I like, you know what I like? I like the little sandcastles he makes.
And the fact that he has time to make them, by the way.
Yeah, like it doesn't make any, there's a lot in this movie that don't make any sense. Because like, how is he constructing these like tiny little monuments of like Abu Simbel and like all these like random ass like historical locations in Egypt with just like water and sand? What?
Ask a 9-year-old to build you a sandcastle. They will never get that kind of detail, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, he's way too smart for a 9-year-old. There's like
he reads ancient Egyptian. Yeah.
Yeah. They also like introduce a lot of like lore in this movie that don't really like make sense if you consider the first one. Like how Rachel Weisz's character is also like a reincarnation of like an ancient Egyptian princess, like Nefertiti, and like she's witnessed Onyx and Amun and Imhotep killing the pharaoh. Like that doesn't happen in the first one. Like she was just off screen screaming in the first one. Okay, like I don't know. I still love
this. Directed by George Lucas, he would go back and then and he would edit in her screaming in the background. Yeah. Like, and they're killing him, and we'll be like, ah! from like the far away.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why you guys are getting these mixed up. It's pretty simple to tell the two apart. If it's funny and good, it was the first one. If it's bland and boring, it's in the second one. This one, like, I don't know what this trend is with these films, like these types of films. It was the case with Jurassic Park 2, even though I do like that film overall. It was the case with Indiana Jones 2, which I don't like, and this film, which I didn't like. Like, it is such a hollow, like, shell of the original film, and they try to spice it up. They add a child to the mix, which is not good. It's not a good actor. It's not funny. It's not inventive. It's bad. Like, I've never liked a child film in any of these sequels, or a child character in any of these sequels, and any of like the fun like action, it's done so much better in the first one. Like, why bother with the second, with the sequel? It really doesn't do it for me. I felt I did not like this one really at all, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, for a very, very brief moment in time, this used to be my favorite out of them, because I was 8 years, because I saw it when I was little, and then I watched it when I was 8 years old, and I was like, oh, that kid is me, and that's, I'm going on adventures, and I have cool parents who are archaeologists, and there's action and excitement. And then I rewatched it when I was like 11 or 12. I was like, yeah, it's not as good as the first one. And watching it yesterday or 2 days ago or whatever, just, this was rough. Super, super rough. I don't think it's a terrible film, because it's still engaging and fun in its own way. But oof, there's so much wrong with it.
I mean, let's be honest. I thought that I had seen it. I don't think I had seen it before. Like, this was the first time I actually saw it. And holy shit, is this movie bad. I mean, it's not god-awful, especially when, no, I thought it was god-awful, and then I watched the third one. Carson, you say, oh, what is the thing with sequels? It's exactly it's the sequel curse. They don't have an idea for a sequel, and they think, this thing made money, You know, we can make more money. Let's make more money. And then, do we have an idea? No. Let's just put a kid in there. Let's make a kid look like Short Round. Let's borrow a lot from Raiders. Yeah, that'll be great. Just disregard the Nazis. Just make it a cult. It's exactly like Raiders, right? So, it kind of works. And it's just, who cares if the characters have chemistry anymore? Like, let's just put more shit. And then, what Alina said. It's pretty much, let's put more lore in there. Because guess what? We're going to make another one after that if we're successful. And then I think they changed direction halfway through that. But I have a feeling that there's been plans to kind of just continue this, and then they've realized that they can't possibly resurrect Imhotep the third time around because they'll be absolutely fucking abysmal, right? And then what I don't understand personally, how the Scorpion King got himself five films based on this. He's in the film for literally like 30 seconds in the beginning, and then he's a CGI creation that looks like it's like someone who, like the Wachowskis, took like, this type of effects we want for Matrix Reloaded when we're making CGI Neo. He looks absolutely horrendous. I don't know. So this is more sort of evocative of the sort of idea that I had in mind when I was thinking, this is like your teenage years growing facial hair when you think you can, but you can't. Like, this is literally just this. Like, this is full of CGI that doesn't blend in. The compositing is horrible. And nothing in the film makes sense. There's Deus Ex Machina everywhere, as in like, they're stranded up top of a pyramid. Ta-da! They're saved by a guy in a blimp, right? Who gives a shit if it makes sense or not? Nothing makes sense in this film. The only thing that kind of, I have a thing, kind of just saves it, is there's one sequence with little monkeys in there that kind of looks like it's, by the way, lifted from the Lost World, because there's like the high tall grass and whatever. It looks like it just takes... borrows a few pages from The Lost World and borrows quite a lot of pages from The Phantom Menace, because they clearly figured out how to make massive sort of amounts of, call them units, on the screen, and the kind of like the army of Anubis or whatever. This looks like the army of droids in Phantom Menace. So it's kind of like, it's a hot mess, but kind of like Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz, they have enough chemistry between themselves to kind of say, it's okay enough, I suppose. If I had to say that there's one good thing about this, there's still Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz. They're just likable people, I'd say, and that would be the sort of the saving grace. The kid I could take or leave, like, he's kind of annoying. But yeah. The entire sort of section in the British Museum, I was like, for a second I had to rewind. It's like, where are they exactly? Like, they're not in Egypt. Oh, they're in British Museum. And then again, now they're in Egypt. So, okay, that's great. And then, like, all of a sudden, the face tattoo guys in London. How did he get in there? Like, do they not have passports, or what the fuck's happening? Yeah. So it's a bit of a mess. Yeah. So these are my opening impressions. Isn't that very good?
There are still some iconic moments, though. I really like the bus ride scene in London when they're like fighting all the mummies on the bus, and then like it's over, and then our Magia warrior face tattoo guy. Is like, that was my first bus ride. I just thought, it's so fucking endearing. I love him.
No, but then, like, the whole the bus sequence I have a problem with, because this is a callback, right? Because in the first one, they resurrect these sort of mummy warriors that are supposed to be scary. And in the first one, they actually are kind of powerful. And then there is a fight scene that kind of makes sense. In this one, they're inconsequential. They're kind of like the Terminators in like Terminator 3 or 4 or whatever. Like, you don't give a shit about them because there's so many of them. Like, they're kind of like, they don't pose a threat. And then they're just, I don't know, they're not even goofy enough. It's kind of like, they're an excuse to showcase how CGI effects are awesome at the time, and they didn't actually age very well either.
I don't know. I always thought it was kind of spooky when like the one like climbs up on the wall and is like running along the like building side of the wall on like her legs. It that freaks me out as a kid. I hated that.
But does it freak you out now?
It still freaks me out now, but okay. Like as a child, I was like, that was like the one that I could not do. I hated that part.
Well, say I do think that's like probably the best action set piece in the film, because it's also still the most practical outside of the creatures. We're just talking about the enemies in this film. One thing that just annoys me so much is that you have these super powerful beings who could kill some people and actually do kill some people with just like 2 seconds, just flick of their fingers. But whenever they get in front of the protagonists of our heroes, they just throw them.
Yeah.
Even the mummies, they're the bastards are just like, I'm going to hold you and just scream at you and just wait for someone to shoot me.
They're inconsequential Terminators. That's what they are. Because there's diminishing returns in the sequels because they're no longer scary. So, you know, because they're all of a sudden, like Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz, they're all like, oh, yeah, well, they're at home with, oh, mummies are just a thing now. Because that's the part of their life. So it's like, it makes no sense. And then in terms of like the actual CGI effects, I have to say, as much as I like the idea and pacing of the sort of the little monkey sort of set piece, the effects are horrendous.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes. When you have the close-ups of the monkeys just screaming at Jonathan.
One thing I kind of found funny was when Jonathan was trying to close the door and Brendan Fraser goes like, these people don't use doors. So that was one thing I kind of just giggled a little bit, but that's it.
And the other one is with the monkeys, when like Jonathan is with one of the henchmen and they're just running away together and they get in a like section and there's tombs or whatever. And it's like, oh, this is a burial ground. They cannot come in here. And then just one of them comes, just shoots the henchman. I thought that was funny. That one worked. But so many others.
They really did the rock dirty with the CGI.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
They did horrendous. The rock dirty. It's so bad. Like, honestly.
And he growls like, rrr.
Yeah. In both movies, I like recognize that the CGI is like not amazing, but I could like, it doesn't bother me, except for like when the rock like, is a literal fucking scorpion. Like, it just looks so bad.
I mean, what's the sort of decision? Like, whose idea was this? They called him the Scorpion King and they showed him, like he's this massive real person. Like, Dwayne Johnson looks like an absolute demigod just on his own, right? Mm-hmm. He looks amazing. And when he was younger, oh my God. And by the way, I didn't know it was his first role. I thought Walking Tall was his first role, but it wasn't. No, that was his first role. No.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you take this guy that you show me this guy in the first 5 minutes as he's this badass who eats live scorpions, right? And then he just, I don't know, disappears into the sand or whatever. And then you decide to, when you resurrect him, not to use the actual actor. And then to make him like a centaur, sort of, I don't know, like half scorpion, half human with little, you know, snippy like snappy things.
He definitely could have been just like a regular person.
Yeah, exactly. Like why is it
not make him tall? Like
just a guy with an axe, and then just fight that fucker. Like,
make him like 2 feet taller, maybe.
I mean, he's just tall. He's already tall anyway.
Yeah, but if you want, like, you know, the big boss vibe, you make him a bit bigger. But as it is, it's just, again, like, what they needed was at least, like, kill one of the side characters by him, because it does nothing. It just comes in, I'm going to smack you around a couple times, and then I'm just going to die.
Yeah.
That's it.
Like, I don't know. Like, I would have preferred if, but then that's exactly, that's the sequel hubris as well. And that's hubris of early 2000s, of like, I know what we can do. We can make him totally CGI and it's going to work and doesn't because he looks like Neo in Matrix Reloaded and so looks horrendous. Like, especially when they have the audacity to show like a close up of a CGI face and he just makes this sort of.
Yes.
Fuck off.
That's burned in my mind ever since I was a child. Like, this smirking face of the scorpion.
All of a sudden, Imhotep looks like Hannibal Lecter in comparison, as far as villains go.
did any of you guys like watch The Scorpion King?
No,
not recently.
Okay,
it's been 10 years.
So I'll do a little tangent then. Okay. Since we were not actually talking, so I watched it this morning, and this is like the first time I've like watched it in quite a few years. Like, we never owned this one on like VHS or DVD, but I've seen it like a couple times on like TV, so I like knew the basic plot and remembered like what happens. So like, it's. The movie is like the origin story of how he like becomes the Scorpion King. So like, he's not an Egyptian. He's like something called an Akkadian. And he's just like running around doing like rock things and like assassinating people. And this like dude gives him like a whole bunch of rubies and was like, hey, there's this asshole named like Memnon. I'm going to give you a bunch of rubies to kill him because like this Memnon guy is like killing all these like little tribes. Like this is pre-pyramid days. So like Egypt is not united. So it's all like a bunch of little tribes.
So is like, he like immortal, by the way, or something like that, that he lives for like hundreds of years?
The scorpion? Like the rock? No.
No, not the rock.
Like oh, Memnon?
No. The Scorpion King, not Dwayne Johnson.
No, because he doesn't become the Scorpion King until the very, very end of the movie.
Oh, okay. So he's just a guy.
Okay. And so he's supposed to kill this like Memnon guy because all the other Egyptian tribes are like, hey, this guy keeps killing all the other tribes. I don't want that to happen to us. What the fuck? And like the reason this Memnon dude is like so powerful is he has like a sorceress named Cassandra and she can like see the future and she's like, oh, you need to do this so you win this victory, blah blah blah. So like the rock's task is actually to kill the sorceress, not Memnon. But then he finds out the sorceress is like a really pretty girl, and there's like this part when he like sees her for the first time. She comes out of the bath and she's like naked, but like her long hair like totally covers her like boobs just like perfectly. She's like one of those like beautiful perfect women, and the rock is like, oh my god, I don't want to kill her because she's so pretty. Cassandra the sorceress reveals that she hates like Memnon too, and then she like defects to the rock side, and then like they go on like a little adventure, and then they kill Memnon. And then because Memnon is only king of his tribe, it's the most powerful warrior that becomes king. So since the rock, he's Scorpion King now. I have no idea why he's the Scorpion King, where the scorpions come in, but like he's king. And then it ends. And then maybe the five other fucking movies that I haven't seen explain how he becomes a literal goddamn scorpion. But like there's no explanation for how he becomes an actual scorpion other than like being cursed by Anubis, I guess. And like it doesn't even explain why he lost like all of his armies and stuff. Like at the very end of the Scorpion King, the rock asks Cassandra like, how long is this gonna last? And she's like, well, peace doesn't last forever. And then like they kind of give the camera a look and then it ends, and I'm like, okay. So like the reason the rock is like alone in the desert at the beginning of the Mummy is some unexplained reason of peace will never last.
Oh Jesus.
So the Scorpion King movie is kind of useless, honestly.
Nice.
No, but I kind of, you know, this is again like the sort of sequel hubris thing. Oh yeah, we can spin this off based on literally like 180 seconds of screen time, like, because he doesn't really feature in the film. Like, it's, I don't know, they keep talking about the Scorpion King this, Scorpion King that, but he's literally a MacGuffin, right?
Yes. Oh yes.
Yeah. And then there's one thing I can't, it's not that I have a problem with, but I kind of found it a little bit hilarious. Have you seen Asterix and Obelix Mission Cleopatra?
No.
Because that was the film that came, I want to say, 1 or 2 years after this. And he literally just, everything's kind of like, in terms of aesthetics, like Cleopatra was played by Monica Bellucci in there. And then she's literally based on that, like in terms of like what she looks like, on the actress that played Anuk Simon. Jesus, what's her name? Alina, help me, please.
Anuk Sinamun.
Yes. So and then the Pharaoh, because they have this. By the way, like, it's such a messy thing. It took me a little while. Just, what the fuck's happening? Oh, they're having a vision as they're fighting, and they're having a vision simultaneously. As in, Rachel Weisz has a vision in a blimp, and then she nearly falls off of it. And then the other woman has a vision simultaneously, while Imhotep goes like, ah, look, she's having a vision. Like, and then the Pharaoh, who's in the background, he looks like the guy in Asterix and Obelix. I might as well hold on. I'll find him. I'll share my screen so you'll see, because you haven't seen the film.
Okay.
I've seen it like ages ago, like once when I was a kid.
It's not a very good film. No, but when I was a kid, I watched like the cartoons that this was based on. I was growing up.
Great.
Yeah.
Honestly, the whole cult thing in this movie doesn't really make a lot of sense.
So many things don't make sense.
The like screen sharing thing.
Oh yes.
I have thoughts. I have some thoughts.
There it is. Hold on. Can you see this?
Yeah.
Yes.
He looks like Pharaoh in Dragon Ball. Mummy returns Pharaoh. Where's the guy? There he is. Tell me it's not real. Yeah, and then you know, like the Unluck Cinnamon, like look at her. Yeah. And look how Monica Bellucci is kind of always kind of there. Like I don't know, in holy shit, where is this? In here. Like she's basically just stylized and she's supposed to be all this sort of like, well, side boob everywhere. It's kind of like almost seductive and whatever.
You know, for children.
Like even on the, yeah, well, this was for children. Yeah, like I'm not kidding. Like look at this. Like it's literally this Unluck Cinnamon, right? But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can see how this is kind of like, but that film came out 2003?
Yeah.
2002. Yeah.
Right after, basically.
Right after, yeah. So I can't say that this was inspired in any way. Probably wasn't. But yeah, it was kind of like a fun little wrinkle. I was thinking, oh, this guy looks like this guy from Asterix and Obelix. But yeah.
Okay. Brief little tangent before I talk about this cult. You know how the reason, like, the Pharaoh figures out that, like, Unluck Cinnamon was touched because her body paint was, like, smeared? Mm-hmm. What if she did that herself? She easily could have. It was on her fucking shoulder. Maybe she was just like, hey, I'm kind of chilly, and rubs her like, what? He like, that's stupid. It doesn't make sense.
Well, in his defense, it's in Cairo. So, you know, it's pretty hot in there. So it's like, it's not like I was fucking chilly. It's like, no, it's 35 degrees.
Well, she's naked all the time. And it gets cold at night in the desert. It was at night. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like it would have been better if like the Pharaoh had like just walked in on them kissing.
Deserts get better. Extremely cold at night.
Yeah. Especially then, you know, like in this little vision fight scene. They don't really hide this. Like Imhotep just walks around and go like, yeah, fucking, I'm gonna bang this. Yeah, like he's just like giving their looks. I'm like, how do you not see this? Like, Pharaoh, Jesus, get a grip. Like, you don't really have to just leave fingerprint paint on this woman to know that this guy's, you know, I don't know.
Well, also, can we talk about like just why, one of the reasons why the sequel makes no fucking sense is that the entirety of the first film is Imhotep waking up, seeing Evie, looking at her and going, yeah, she looks like an Aksunamu. I think she's like reincarnated or something. I have to use her body for my future wife. And then in the sequel, it's actually, oh no, wait, he actually saw her in the past. Like she was there. She's the reincarnation of Nefertiti, and she was in the past, and you see her in a flashback, and clearly sees her. So it's like, why doesn't he connect the two? Why did you change it? Why did you make it like this?
Maybe he was like, well, this girl looks like a girl I knew, so like close enough. The thing that I don't like is like where this cult, so yeah, it's like 10 years after the first Mummy movie. So like, did this cult like stem from them hearing about Imhotep like coming back to life? Or was it like a thing before? And like, where did they find this like Unluck Cinnamon's reincarnation? Her name is Mila. So like, where the fuck was she in the first movie? Did she just like hear about this? It was like, hey, I kind of think I look like an Unluck. How do they know what she looks like? Like all these people, it doesn't make sense. And then like when Imhotep and like Mila / Unluck meet for the first time, she's like, I'm an Unluck reincarnated. And he's like, only in body, not in soul. And I'm like, what? If she's reincarnated, wouldn't it be her soul and not her body? I hate this.
But then in the first one, I can understand because Carson, help me out. In the original Mummy, that's basically the premise, that he sees there is this woman who thinks is a reincarnation of his long lost love from the very, very long past, right? Mm-hmm. So that was like, oh yeah, so that's basically a callback that keeps this a remake of the Universal monster, sort of the Mummy. But then it makes no sense when you try to kind of expand on this, because what are you going to do with a sequel? Do it again? No, they have to kind of just make people forget that, oh, this happened, especially that he looks at her and says, oh, you look exactly like you said, like, oh, you look exactly like my girlfriend. No, she doesn't. Like, the other one looks like his girlfriend. So it's kind of like, okay. I don't know. And it's all kind of like, oh, everyone's now a reincarnation of someone. So, yeah. So it might as well. Rick has this little, like, mark on his body. So I was half expected, oh, he's going to be a reincarnation of the Scorpion King at some point, and they'll just pretend he's Dwayne Johnson. But
I thought it was so funny how they just like explain how he had a tattoo this whole time because it was like underneath his bracelet. I always assumed like as a child that he got that tattoo after this like whole mummy thing happened, but apparently he's had it like the whole time. They just hid it in the first one and he's like supposed to be a descendant of like a Magi warrior. And I'm like, so he just randomly got this tattoo.
But did they plan it in advance, or is this just a tattoo that Brendan Fraser has?
No, like it's the mark of the Magi in the first movie. So like as a kid in the second movie, as like I'm watching the second movie and I assumed he got this tattoo after the events of the mummy. I don't know, to like commemorate his experience or something. But as I was rewatching it again, they like say that he's had this like tattoo like this whole time. It's just like random. And I'm like, No, it should not be random.
But this is such a because it's literally like Back to the Future Part Two, like trying to retrofit shit that wasn't in the first film so that they can build upon this and then maybe make another sequel based on this so that it makes you think that it makes sense, but it doesn't. It's just
It doesn't add anything. The whole tattoo thing. It's like, oh, because you were destined to kill the mom. It's like, okay, and then. That it was destined. Okay, it was already super cool doing that shit in the first film. What does it add to the second one? What does it give the character? It just goes, oh yeah, maybe I have to do what I was still going to do, which is save the world and save the day. Just it doesn't add anything. No, it's a waste. It's just connections between him and Ardeth Bay. It's like, sure, whatever.
I don't know. Carson, where do you stand on this?
I mean, I really don't have that much more to add. Like, it's just bad. The more you talk about it, the more I find I dislike it. Like, the first film has that fun energy, and this one just it dies. It doesn't have that energy. It doesn't have that fun. It's not a rewarding experience. I really don't see why anyone would ever consciously be like, oh, I'm going to watch this when you could just watch the original. Like, it doesn't add anything. It's just a shell of the original that I could definitely go without.
Yeah, but interesting enough, it made a shit ton of money.
Even more money.
Yeah, it made way more money than the original did. But then again, it was riding on the coattails on the fact that the first one was actually okay. Or like a lot of people really liked it. And then they went to see the second one and they were like, holy, no, bad Stephen Sommers. Like, this is just not good.
I still really, really like the second one. I just acknowledge that, like, the retconning of the lore is kind of stupid. I still, like, I have a great time watching this movie. Like, every time I watch The Mummy, like, we would watch The Mummy on, like, a Friday, and then we'd watch Mummy Returns on a Saturday. Or we'd watch, like, Mummy one weekend, and then the next weekend we'd watch Mummy Returns. Like, we always would, like, just watch them together. I feel like that's why they like blend so much in my mind.
I mean, I get the idea of, okay, it has this sort of like a Jurassic Park problem, as in, how are you going to make a sequel? Do exact same all over again, but just slightly different. Like, because you could argue that some of the sort of successful franchises in the past, they were basically making the same film four times in a row. The Terminator, same film three times in a row, right? This thing, same thing twice in a row. Like Jurassic Park, same thing three times in a row or something like this. It's all the same. And it's all because, I don't know, someone in Universal thinks, oh, we've made money, let's make more money. And it's just like, put a kid in it. Like they have like a standard sort of like book of formulas that they'll just apply to it. And they'll say, yeah, let's make more, put more effects, put more money in there. Put like a bankable star in, or put like a, I don't know, just more CGI, more of everything. More color, more everything. Don't stop. More set pieces. Make it longer.
More nonsense. Yeah.
What I find really interesting is how this series and this franchise breaks the formula after this. Because clearly Universal liked how this film was doing. They wanted to establish the Mummy franchise. They opened up the ride for it at like all their theme parks and stuff in 2004, which is 2 years after this. But then we didn't get another Mummy film for years. I mean, it wasn't like the series, like Indiana Jones, you got that third one and then you went, you know, took a break, then you go to four. Jurassic Park, very similar. You don't get number three. They do the Scorpion King thing, I fully appreciate, but like it feels weird.
Scorpion King was it 2002?
Like 1 year soon after. Like
right after.
Yeah.
Okay. Because
when you think still you would get a main Mummy film before 2008 was? I don't even know what year
it was. The third one comes out in 2008.
2008. Yeah.
So seven years later.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
How many Scorpion Kings were in between the second and third Mummy? Three?
One or two tops, I think.
Yeah, they made a lot of them in like the mid-2010s, the Scorpion King
for
ones.
Reason.
For some godforsaken reason. I will not watch those.
Scorpion King 2 is of 2008, yeah.
Because like The Rock is not even in them. And I was like looking on Letterboxd and the only person I know who has seen them other than Nicolo Art is Jack. And both of you have given them like all one stars. And like poor Jack has seen up to four and it's given them all one stars. It's like, why did you put yourself through that?
Okay, so I'm just on Wikipedia now. So The Scorpion King 2002, as you said, then same year as The Third Mummy, and then 2012, 15, and 18.
Mm-hmm. That's why I don't claim those. The Rock's not even in them. They don't exist.
No. It's but like I can understand how they wanted to break the formula for the third one, because they literally would have to do, I mean, they still do the same film third time, only they were like, let's put it in China and make it interesting, because like you'd have to find like,
well, they don't have morals, they don't have standards.
I know,
with peace and love, like don't be like, oh, they wanted to break it because like artistic intent, like fuck them, they don't care.
And also, like, if you think about the third one, do you know who he's directed by?
I know nothing about it, no.
Okay, the third one's directed by a guy called Rob Cohen. Do you know who he is?
No.
Okay, he's most famous for making, like, I don't know, Daylight or Triple X, did he do? The Fast and the Furious. And he's recently most famous for allegedly date raping his own child.
Oh.
This is taking a turn.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Like, yeah, just hold on. Because I was trying to, because I was watching this and I was just thinking to myself, okay, who's this guy? And I'm googling this this is turning into another sort of episode of like tangential confessions. What did he do? I'm just trying to look for filmography, and then you don't scroll to filmography before you go into this section, nice section on Wikipedia saying sexual abuse allegations. And then listen to this. On February 21st, 2019, Cohen's transgender daughter, Valkyrie Weather, accused Cohen of sexually assaulting her as a child, as well as sexually assaulting another woman. And then she further claimed that Cohen had taken her to visit sex workers in Thailand and then Czech Republic when she was 13, supposedly in an attempt to turn her straight. It's
the father right there.
And also, Aisha Argento alleged that Cohen drugged her with GHB and raped her during filming of Triple X. So yeah, so there's that. there's quite a bit attached to this guy.
It's a class act. Yeah, and he makes shit films.
He made Alex Cross.
Classic.
The Fast and the Furious. Daylight and Dragonheart. 1996 was his year.
Jesus.
But now I'm just reading this like, holy Christ, this is now. The third one is just an absolute mess, and it doesn't make, like, if you think the second one, Carson, if you think the second one doesn't make sense, the third one's just a fucking.
Did you watch this? Did Carson watch the third one?
I think no.
Okay, nope. Don't. So you don't need
That's
to.
That's a shame. That's a shame.
Okay, hold on. One thing I want to say before we like talk about the third one is the thing. Okay, hold on, words.
Focus. Compose yourself.
The thing about The Mummy Returns is that is the movie that makes me like empathize with Imhotep a lot more than the first one, purely because of the scene at the end when like Imhotep and like Rick are like about to fall into like the underworld and all the like stones are crashing down in the temple, and then like Evie and Anouk Sinamoon are in like the hallway, and like they're being like, Rick and Imhotep are being like pulled into like the underworld by all these like creepy disgusting mummy soul things, and then like Evie runs through all the like falling rocks and stuff to rescue Rick, and Anouk Sinamoon leaves Imhotep, and I'm like, you guys had a love story that lasted like 3,000 years, and then she doesn't run for him. Oh, poor guy. I just feel so bad for him.
Just his face. He has the face of someone who's
so sad and crushed and heartbroken. And just he was like, go. I did all that for you. Oh, I'm so sad for him.
I can get this. Because at least, because in terms, like, you don't really see Imhotep as a villain in the second one, because it's a bit of a mess. Because there's this, I mean, you can see him as a villain all throughout the film, but at the end, there's the Scorpion King, who's an absolute mess. But at least you're like, okay, because you see, like, Rick and Imhotep are fighting, and then all of a sudden, oh, there's this guy. We should probably fight him now. yeah. And then they're not really together fighting him, but it's kind of like it's such a mess. But yeah, we can then see, okay, well, maybe he's kind of like a tragic hero almost. But yeah, and he falls into a horrible CGI mess as well. These mummies looking very, very bad.
Yeah. And just his powers in the entire film make no sense, even compared to the first one. He's like Jedi force push and gripping and pulling.
Yeah. This has become a meme right like now. This is not. And I mean, he does this in the first one, like when he opens his mouth really wide.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That I can't buy. I'm sorry. Like, this is one of those things. I'm like, someone should have stepped in and said, "This effect does not look great. Like, please do something else." I don't know.
That was spooky.
Whatever.
Super like, spooky.
I thought it was cool. Speaking
about effects, can we talk about, I don't know their names, so I'm going to sound like a complete idiot here, but all the dog creature bullshit things from the second one, they look
horrendous. Like Anubis Warriors?
Anubis, yes. Oh, Anubis Warriors. Wow.
That's they're, yeah. Wow. Do you know what they look? They look like reskinned droids from Phantom Menace.
No, but like worse. Just worse than that.
Well, much worse, but they look like, in terms of even like the sort of how they're built, like they have this long nose and whatever, they look like literally like someone said, oh yeah, we have these sort of models from the Phantom Menace, it's gonna be cheap to reskin them, and then someone says, yeah, fucking do it.
Yeah, the difference is that like the clones have armor and everything, which kind of hides the overly polished model. These ones are supposed to be like dogs, and they're so shiny, smooth.
All the scenes with sort of these like massive amounts of sort of things on screen, they look like a cutscene from a video game from early 2000s. So that's
what, you know, I think like. I think this franchise is also rather poor when it comes to like the large scale action. Whenever it's the two armies lining up, like I couldn't care at all. Say what you want, like Attack of the Clones, for example, but like the action scene at the end of that, where they're getting surrounded and it's very like supposed to be overwhelming. I believe it's Attack of the Clones.
With all the Jedi in there.
Yeah. Like, when that is when it's like Star Wars, even the prequels are having like large scale action, you get a sense of like you can really buy into it, I think, and it works. Here it feels meaningless. There's something about these big action, like when it's one-on-one or limited, yeah, I think it's better. But when it's like the big armies lining up and battling, it's just boring. It doesn't do anything for me.
Totally agree. I mean, I would say they're at their best, all three of them, and then they're getting progressively worse. But the first one is arguably the best at this. They're best at chase sequences. Yes. You can say, like, even this in the second one, the London sort of bus chase, pretty good in terms of like, okay, well, blocking and then design of the sort of set piece and things that happen on the street. That's pretty great. In the third one, they have one on the streets of, is it Hong Kong or whatever, when they fire a firework into a guy in the
territory. Shanghai.
Is it Shanghai? Yes.
Yeah.
So they literally recreate the sort of set piece from the second one, and they do it with horses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just copy pasted.
Yeah, but if in isolation, if I hadn't seen the second one, I would say, yeah, this is probably the one set piece that kind of looks okay. Mm-hmm. It kind of falls apart when they introduce Yetis to the equation later on. Like, Carson, you're gonna have a fucking blast when you see this.
Like, you honestly should watch it, like, because it's so fucking dumb how like different it is from the first.
How two. You guys okay. are describing it makes me want to put out my watch list.
Okay, yeah, hold on.
And there's Jet Li in it too.
Okay, let me give you people my backstory on Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. So go like. For it. This came out in 2008. I was 11. So like as an 11-year-old, I was not like looking forward to like movies. I just randomly heard about it from my older cousin, Boy, whose actual name is Eshman, but we call him Boy. Like, I didn't know, that's not a tangent we need to get into. So my cousin Boy is like 15 years older than my cousin Derek and I. He's like, hey, children who are 11-year-olds that I like to hang out with because we were cousins, do you want to go see this new mummy movie? And I was like, hell yeah, Boy, I fucking love the mummy movies. Let's go. Not knowing a damn thing about what it was about. And then it opens and we're in fucking China. And I was like, are we in the right theater?
Yeah, that's exactly what is happening?
Why and it's like the mummy? And it's like another 10 years in the future. And like their child, Alec, or Rick and Evie's child, Alex, is like all grown up and is like an archaeologist in China. I'm like, okay. I don't know where China came into this. And then like Rick and Evie are like retired and Evie writes like fucking historical romance novels. That really pisses me off. We can get into that later. And apparently there's like a part where they mentioned they were like spies during like the war or something. And then they just like, why the fuck? There's no mummies in China. Like as a I don't really know a lot about ancient China. No, there's not. Like this movie just pisses me off for so many reasons. There's no reason to leave Egypt. Why the fuck are we in China? At the very, very end of the movie, there's like a joke where like Jonathan goes to Peru because he's like, oh my God, like I'm going to go to a place where there are no mummies, only to discover that mummies have recently been discovered in Peru. So where's my fourth mummy movie when they're in Peru?
And actually, supposed to be an actual sequel.
Yeah, they had one.
Planning to make.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they had one, but they
it was garbage because the third one's fucking terrible. So,
you know what, like, there's a lot of in China, though? People willing to pay money for movie tickets. True. That's why every third film takes place in China.
No, but then,
they introduce. Yeah.
I wouldn't expect that this film was marketed towards the Chinese audience, because there's plenty of things that the Chinese government would probably say that needs to be censored.
Because they don't. The worst thing about it, Rachel Weisz isn't even in it. Yes, so what the hell is the point of this movie?
They recast. Yeah. Like, I thought, oh, is this. Oh, he remarried. Oh, but a bastard. And we're like, oh, no, that's her. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. Let's take the British character played by a British actress and replace her with an American. Yeah. That's wonderful choice.
At this point, I think maybe Rachel Weisz had, I don't know, maybe she had something better to do.
I'm going to, like, the backstory to, like, they got the script, they showed it to Rachel Weisz, and she said, this sucks, I'm not doing it because of bullshit script. And they used an excuse for marketing that was like, oh yeah, she just had a child and she couldn't do this. And she said, no, that's bullshit. I did two other films the same year. I had no problems. I just didn't want to do it because of the script. And another element in the early draft of the script was that Imhotep was supposed to come back as an ally.
Oh, are you serious?
To help them. And Arnold Vosloo read the script and said, that's bullshit. I'm not doing this. And they had a part for Ardeth Bay as well, and he was like, if there's no Imhotep, there's no reason why should I even be here, cut me out.
Like,
so three actors said, fuck this. I mean,
you can see how bad the script was for the initial script was this, when people who actually agreed to be in the second one said, no, I'm out.
Okay, listen,
it's a lot of money too.
I was browsing Wikipedia as I was watching Tomb of the Dragon Emperor this morning, so like when I watched the third one this morning, it was the first time I've seen it since that 2008 theatrical experience.
Okay.
So because I figured I should watch it since you people were also watching it, and I was like, okay, maybe my opinion has changed. It has not changed. But I was reading about like how Rachel Weisz didn't come back, and apparently they said that she didn't want to come back because she didn't want people to think that she would be like old enough to have a 21-year-old son. I'm like, that is like, there's no way she actually said that. Like, why the fuck are there's no way. Like, obviously Rachel Weisz is not a personal friend of mine. I wish she was, but like, what the fuck? I feel like that's like a made up rumor to make her look bad, and I hate it. Cause like, no, the movie's just shitty, and that's why she didn't want to come back.
There's one thing I was thinking, that it's not even a saving grace, but if there was a saving grace about this film, there's one thing I kind of just latched onto, and I'm going to die on this hill. Okay, not Rachel Weisz. What's the actress's name?
Maria Bello.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she's introduced as she's talking about a book. I mean, she's reading from her book, I think, right? Mm-hmm. And the book's called The Mummy Returns, right?
Yep.
And I'm just thinking, what if, okay, all these adventures that she had, she wrote the book called The Mummy. And on this, and she wrote it in 1920. Let's just say in 1927. And this book then was adapted by the Universal into the original Mummy in the 1932. So technically, The Mummy from 1999 is a prequel, not a remake.
Huh.
And then the Mummy in the 1932 takes place in like a movie universe, because it's based on a book that was written by a fictional character in the Mummy made 60 years later. I'm a genius. I'm sorry. And yeah, that's the only way, that's the only thing I like about this film. It's the theory. I just do,
don't you, know. You dare try to lump my 1932 masterpiece into this shit.
Okay. So
no, but literally just this is a horrible film. Like, Carson, don't even try watching it. It's a waste of time. It's the shortest, by the way.
Yeah. Thank God. It like that's actually makes lit. Me really mad. It really makes me mad how Evie's character is like treated in this movie. Because she's a badass in the first one, and she's an even badder ass in the second
one. She shoots shotguns in the second one.
Yeah. And like she is so into like ancient Egypt and stuff. And like the fact that make her retired and she's writing fucking bullshit historical romance novels. How dare you? I realize I have talked a lot of shit about the British Museum on this podcast and on Clappercast, but if we're considering the 1940s British Museum, I don't really care about decolonization in that context. She should be running the British Museum, or at the very least, the fucking Egypt wing of the British Museum. She should not be retired writing goddamn historical romance novels. Fuck what? You. I hate it.
They turned her, I mean, pardon for French, they turned her into a wife, into a mother. They just domesticated this woman. Like, mm-hmm. She's basically all she does is she complains and she just smacks her son across the head, like, what do you think you're doing? Like she's just, don't mother me. Like, Jesus, calm down, right? Like, she's literally just an annoying mom. That's what she is. Like, I don't know.
And she's goofy.
And I have to buy the fact that she's apparently a super spy. So they gave her like an egg to take to China. I'm like, fucking hell, really? Yeah, Carson, you're gonna have a blast. I'm telling you.
I mean, there's Yetis, so
and that's Yetis, the main drawing point. That sounds. Yetis. Do the Yetis look good at least?
No,
they have fur this time around. I mean, they have fur, so that's good.
Yeah, they. Do you know what they look like? Like, they look kind of like Sully from Monsters, Inc., kind of, sort of, but white.
Yeah, they're like snow.
Was that the inspiration for your tweet? Did that make you think of Sully? Okay.
No. I just saw the someone posted on Twitter, and like, you know, image of Kong, and I was just like, this guy looks like Sully, and I'm like, yeah, he does. Yeah. I don't know. The second one looks like a masterpiece in comparison. Like, I'll put it this way.
Oh, yeah. At least it's entertaining and enjoyable from beginning to end, even if it's not good.
This one isn't. I just really don't like the character choices in the third movie. Like, Evie is so different. Rick is really different, too. Like, in the second one, he's a father, but in this one, he's, like, a really fucking annoying father. And I'm like, he wouldn't do that. Like, the relationship that, like, Rick and Evie have with Alex is just, like, so bizarre. Like,
can't talk to him to his son, no?
Yeah, they like have such a good relationship. Like, I realize teenage years are very difficult, but what the hell happened in those like teenage years?
I think World War II happened. I just
idolized. Yeah, that's true. Like he idolizes Evie and Rick, and like he learns ancient Egyptian and all these things, and all of a sudden he's suddenly like really into like ancient China. That's the other thing, is like there's no mention of like Evie liking anything other than like Egypt, and all of a sudden she like vaguely knows like a bunch of like Chinese legends and like Mandarin and like what the fuck.
She does.
She should not.
Like the one character from King of the Monsters who knows like the lore of every single like historical monster,
just like it doesn't make sense, because typically when you're like an history person, you have like one focus, and her focus is Egypt. So there's like, I don't buy that she knows all this random shit about China. I don't buy it.
I mean, she's super cool.
It doesn't happen too much in the second one. In the third one, it does happen. And I actually did have the same thought of, like Carson, you just said, like, oh, it's like King of the Monsters when like, I don't know, something happens. And then she randomly says, he's at full power now. How the fuck do you know? It's just like, oh. What's this? Is this in some kind of a book that you just I don't know. It's a mess. Yeah. Third one is just
Third one is a parody.
It made money though. Third one still made money. The Mummy 2017 still made money. Like, you know, this is a franchise that's making money. I'm sure there's gonna be another one soon. Maybe we'll get that Peru sequel, you know? That would be good.
I love it.
No,
the belated sequel.
This is a franchise.
20 years in the making.
I don't know, just refuses to die. I'm not sure if it makes money. How much money did it make?
Not a ton of money. Like money.
400 million,
Jesus.
Also, what, 125 million budget around there?
No, so yeah. I suppose it's just about broke even, or just made I don't know, some money.
Made money, keeps the IP alive, you know? Yeah. I definitely think we're going to see another Mummy film. I don't know what it's going to look. I don't know.
I mean, we did see like sequel to this. It made enough money that at some point someone thought, oh yeah, let's make another Mummy film and let's make it a remake, but it took them 10 years to do it. So yeah.
Yeah. I've not that's watched because the 2017 Mummy, and I feel like I never will, because I just like, if the third one makes me this pissed off, I can't imagine what like a remake would do to me.
Let's just say this, you know, the 2017 Mummy makes the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen look like an absolute look like the Suicide Squad. Like, this is just, you know.
You definitely don't need to catch up with it, because there will be no Dark Universe. But
yeah.
Yeah, that's and that they had the goal to start with the Dark Universe logo in the beginning. It was great.
It's a good logo though, and they had like a trailer featuring all the original Universal monsters. That's like a sick little trailer.
Oh yeah, but this, I mean, I appreciate
to sell a box set.
This was this was a nice gamble. It's like, put our dick on the table. Let's make this happen. This is happening, and all of a sudden this thing flops, and I'm like, holy shit! How
I remember people laughing in the theater. Just the film opens up, and there's the Dark Universe, it was just either laughing or being like, what's that? It's a production company?
I definitely feel like in 1 year for Alina's next birthday, we have to do 2017's The Mummy, right? No, like, that definitely feels...
I feel like we have to do it. 25, I can't.
The lost cinematic universe. Come on. Maybe it's good. Maybe this is like, maybe it's worth actually talking about,
I think maybe a year or two from now, I think The Mummy in general would be probably an interesting Uncut Gems episode, yeah.
This one again?
No, The Mummy 2017. But I wouldn't say like, yeah, let's do it for Alina's birthday just to piss her off.
I'll be turning 25. I can't
What I would suggest, maybe, are you okay to do like a
pirate another film? Year longer than one the of, Dark one Universe?
One of the pirates films.
Sorry, what?
One of the pirates films next year for your birthday.
Sure. I didn't realize we got yearly birthday movies. I'm in.
everyone gets a birthday movie. Nicola, when's your birthday?
23rd of August.
There you go.
What's your birthday movie? Pick it right now.
Yeah. What's it going to be?
I'll have to look like something by John Woo, probably.
Thanks. Oh, hold
on. Shit action movie. Let's go.
Either Face Off or Mission Impossible 2.
23rd
I'm going to take your face off. So good.
I'm
such a good film. Such a good movie.
Talk about the Uncut Gem.
You know what else pisses me off about Tomb of the Dragon Emperor? What? Jet Li and Michelle Yeoh are so fucking wasted in this.
Oh yeah.
Why did they sign on to this movie? They're wasted. It makes me
money.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're I don't know. They haven't done anything sort of massive in a while, because I think wasn't Michelle Yeoh in one of the Bond films or something like this early 2000s.
She was, and then she was in the Mechanic Resurrection. Just like a small part in.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's almost, I don't know, it's more interesting to kind of just I don't know, the Mummy, the 1999 Mummy is interesting to talk about as a sort of like a product of nostalgia towards the 30s, at least in my mind, and then maybe towards Alina's childhood. But the whole franchise is like as a thing that just happened is almost like more interesting sort of topic, because I haven't like who made the decisions to make the sequels the way they were, like, and then they had the, I don't know, like who decided that Imhotep needs to come back in the second for no fucking reason, because I don't know.
It's so easy.
And then they got Jet Li. I mean, Jet Li was big in like, I don't know, 4 years before that. No? When was like the fourth Lethal Weapon?
It's like 9. Oh, which funnily enough, the screenwriters of The Mummy Tomb of the Dragon Emperor are the same ones who made Lethal Weapon 4, which is incredibly random. Incredibly random, yes. Yes. Miles Miller and Alfred Gogh. And they also made Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Nights.
Jeez.
And Herbie, Fully Loaded. Because why not? It's like, yeah, sure. They like China, I guess.
No,
and Jet Li.
Yeah, so Michelle Yeoh, she was in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the year 2000. And then that was kind of her, let's just say that was her. Oh, and then before that, she was in Tomorrow Never Dies. Yeah, I knew she was in a Bond movie.
Yeah.
And then she was in Memoirs of a Geisha, Fearless. So, oh, she was in Sunshine. Yeah, so she wasn't like, I don't know, she was in a few films and then she was kind of just, I don't know, didn't do much. So I suppose she needed this, she needed the money.
I guess, but even so, they wasted her. I mean, this nothing. Whole movie is just like a waste. The only, before I watched it this morning, the only thing I remembered from this movie was that the like Emperor's body was like a decoy and he was actually in like one of the like horse chariot thingies. And I distinctly remembered the scene at the very beginning when Rick is like fly fishing and it's going terribly and he keeps getting like hooks in his neck and then he just like gets really frustrated and starts like shooting all the trout with a gun and then Evie's like, oh, I'm so happy you found a hobby that doesn't involve guns, and then she crunches into a bullet. That is like the one funny part. That's the only thing.
Although
that
I was just thinking,
can say for
if you shot a trout this size with a gun, this wouldn't look this nice on a plate.
I know.
Bits of fish.
It just this looked like, and like, is this canned? No, it's not, like I thought they caught it.
It's horrible. And I would say, like, yeah, the tone of the film is just terrible.
It's all over the place.
It's a gradual decline from the first one. Just the second one already adds the kiddie element that's more pandering to children, which worked. It worked when I was little.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they
but with the third one, it's just horrible.
I mean, they
it's
do
slapstick.
They pull from Indiana Jones yet again. Like, they do it in every single one of them. Like, in the first one, they do it kind of subtly, and then in the second one, they pull from like, there is a set piece inspired by Raiders of the Lost Ark when she just picks up the artifact and it's like, it's too late to put it back now, right? Or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In the third one, it's literally like The Last Crusade when, like, oh, he has a relationship with his son that's kind of shitty. Like, it's... I don't know. It looks like it's just this whole franchise is. I mean, franchise. The whole three films. They had a nice pitch for the first one, and then they decided let's roll with this, and then they realized that they were rolling with a literally like an elevator pitch that's like three sentences long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, I mean, it's a nice curiosity, and then I'm amazed that this made this much money, especially in the year. Like, think about it, the third one came out in the year where The Dark Knight was out. Iron Man was out. What else was out in 2008? Like,
it
was
Indiana Jones 4.
That was 2008.
Yes.
Holy Jesus. It's so you know.
I think because so many people find the first. Oh my God, English. I think it's because so many people find the first two movies like it's something that's so like beloved to them that they went to see the third one, and then we were all like, "What the fuck is this shit?" So that's exactly what happened to me and my family. Like, I don't think any of us like the third Mummy movie. Like, I don't claim it. I never wanted to watch it again, and I only did to see if my opinion had changed. It has not. So,
it's only gotten worse.
Yeah, I think this was basically made money based on inertia alone. But mm-hmm. then think about this: number one highest grossing films of 2008. I think it's just this is worldwide. Because The Dark Knight was number one and made almost $1 billion. Second one, Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm.
That's a surprise to me. Kung Fu Panda, Hancock, Carson. Oh. Do you know what's next?
What is that?
Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia, yeah.
Hell yeah, it is.
I mean, this made so much money. Madagascar, Escape to Africa, Quantum of Solace, Iron Man, Wall-E, and The Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian. Oh, that's another franchise that went completely off the rails very quickly.
Jesus, yeah. I mean, more consistent than the Mummy movies.
Yeah, but this one was like, oh yeah, another Chronicles of Narnia film is in the cinemas. Like, I don't even give a shit. Did they make more than two? No.
Yes, the Valiant. No, wait. The Voyage of the Boat.
Don't trade. Treader.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is an episode. I'm sorry. This goes on a bingo card again. I think. Carson's like, I'm not doing this.
I've never watched any of them.
I haven't either. Yeah.
You haven't.
I've only seen the first one.
I've seen all three of them.
We have like 600 films on our list. I think we can leave Chronicles of Narnia.
No, it goes on the list because I'll forget later on.
On the C list.
Yeah. No, there's a... Oh, hold on.
I think it is interesting to explore, like, franchises that have, like, died. Like, yeah. I like...
The Mummy, Paul 2017.
Paul was making fun of us and was like, why the hell are you doing The Mummy on Uncut Gems? Like, everybody loves The Mummy. It's on Uncut Gems. I was like, well, because it's my birthday. Who cares? It's our podcast. We can do whatever the fuck we want. But, you know, as we're talking, it is very interesting to explore, like...
Because the franchise as a whole got
downward spiral.
Yeah, got progressively worse.
Yeah. If anything, you could look at, like, talking in a more historical sense. Like, we have to thank Steven Sommers in a way if we got the resurgence of the Universal films. Because prior to that, like, the rights were absolute shit. Like, everyone was making things, their public domain and whatnot. And to the Mummy, he made Van Helsing in 2004. That was, like, it's insane to think they tried to make...
He made G.I. Joe, Universe, by the way, as well, no?
And he made G.I. Joe. They tried to make the Dark Universe equivalent, like, shared universe thing, four times, and it failed every single one of them. So he made Van Helsing in 2004, which was a disaster, Everyone hated it. Then they made The Wolfman in 2010, thinking, okay, maybe if we go for a gritty, R-rated approach, it would work better, and no one saw it. Then they made Dracula Untold, which no one cared about because it just looks terrible, even though I do enjoy it.
Was there a Dracula 2000 as well before that as well?
No, that wasn't Universal.
Wasn't Universal?
No.
Okay.
I think it was like R-rated, blah, blah, blah. And then The Mummy 2017, and that failed as well. Like, it only ever worked in the 30s and 40s.
Like, yeah, the shared originals. Universe.
Well, then
I did. I had a month where I watched and reviewed all of them, and they're all like, well, they're not all super good, but like, it's a really rewarding experience. All of them. That's a fun.
Like, all of them, as in like,
not all of them, but
the fifth Mummy film, or like, you know, the creature from the Black Lagoon meets the Invisible Man and shit like this.
Well, that's an Abbott Costello, but yeah, I did all the Abbott Costellos, all the Frankensteins, all the Mummies, all the like Draculas, Jesus. All whatever.
At least so I told you this.
The Werewolf's Daughter, whatever that one I sent you, like that one's very good. I did all the werewolves, so like Loki the best, like Lon Chaney Jr., Loki best actor of all time with that performance. But you know, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can see that Steven Sommers was kind of like, I don't know, he did quite well with this, but then his career went off the cliff. Like, what did he do? Like, after 2013, he didn't do anything.
Nope. I still haven't seen Odd Thomas.
He produced quite a few things. He did. Odd Thomas was like 8 years ago. And he's now has apparently something, When Worlds Collide, announced. Okay, so yeah.
At least he's getting money. Executive producer of Scorpion King 4 and 5.
Oh,
and 3. Jesus. Good on him.
Bless him. Bless
him. Did you guys hear that they're making like a Scorpion King TV series and The Rock is like an executive producer?
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Why not?
Dead fucking serious. I mean, like,
it could be good.
Well, yeah.
You think?
Is it?
Let me look. I can't remember. I remember hearing about this. I might be hallucinating it, but I'm pretty sure it's a real thing.
It's super likely. Everything is getting a TV show now.
There was an animated series, The Mummy, that ran from 2001 to 2003.
Yeah. I've never seen that. Yeah. And I saw it when I was like browsing Wikipedia last night. Like, that sounds fun.
I
find that funny because this is clearly not a kid's film. Like, this is not a kid's property.
This would have been a PG film in the 80s. Like, because it's violent and whatever. Yeah. And yeah. But then, like, the longer I think about this, the longer it kind of looks like, in terms of like franchise development, it's like the Planet of the Apes. As in, like, yeah, let's make the same film four times in a row, and then let's make a TV show about it, and then spin it off, and then it's just I don't know, like, it's just Hollywood execs are just like horribly uninspired.
So this is from the Scorpion King Wikipedia.
Okay.
In November 2020, a reboot of the Scorpion King film series was announced to be in development. Blah blah blah. The plot will be taking place in modern day and involve a contemporary adaptation of Matthias/Scorpion King. So like, and then it's like Dwayne Johnson will serve as producer, and it's like a joint production between Universal and then Seven Bucks Productions, which is like The Rock's production company. So I guess they're trying to like make the Scorpion King in modern times.
It's not going to be very good, is it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, historically, this franchise hasn't necessarily hit the nail on the head. So,
no, but think about it. The Mummy 2017. They tried to make it modern day, and look how it turned out.
Yeah. I mean, I trust Dwayne The Rock Johnson with my life, but like, I'm skeptical.
Well, yeah, but then again, he's some of the choices he makes.
The ego is a bit too big now.
You know what? No, he makes money, and even in the worst projects he's in, he's never like bad. You know,
that's true.
That's fine. That's a fine argument. Because he's the man is just oozing charisma. Like he can't lose. Like as a character, he'll just smile. I'm like, I love you, Dwayne. I'm like, this guy, look at him. I can't be mad at you. But yeah. You know,
I know he like prefers taking like big blockbuster movies because, you know, like they make money, and also because like his whole thing was he wants to like prove himself as like an actor. So he takes all these like blockbuster movies because he wants to be known as like an actor rather than like The Rock.
No, but then again, like, with his physique, like he has the Schwarzenegger problem. I mean, he doesn't have an Austrian accent that he has to work through, but then you wouldn't be able to cast him as an everyman successfully. Like, I think he's been an everyman in a few like films, like Snitch or something like this.
Snitch, Faster.
Yeah, but these are kind of like a little more low key productions. But in a bigger sort of film, you wouldn't believe that he's like Bruce Willis in the early 90s. That you could believe that he's just a regular guy who is just like shit happens to him. Because
yeah,
he looks like he's built like a truck. And then he just stands out in a crowd, so he looks like a, you know, like a superhero almost. Like he just left his cape at home.
I don't think it's a problem because he doesn't try to be. Like he takes on like Skyscraper, but like that film, like sure, his character I guess is like technically an everyman, but that film's not trying to pass it off like that. Like
no, but then
it's the badass Dwayne Johnson. Like it's The Rock.
Yeah, exactly. He's not trying to be an everyman. Although he's a family man, but he also has fucking superpowers, right? In like he can jump like an absolute mofo.
Yeah.
That's what I remember from Skyscraper, by the way.
That was a fun film. I liked it.
Yeah.
I liked Rampage. That was fun.
I haven't seen Rampage.
It's fun. I don't know. I like The Rock a lot. I liked it. I think he's a good guy. I like the choices he makes. And like, yeah, it all comes from him like trying to prove himself. So I kind of wish he would do like something like more low key, but I don't think he ever will just based on his personality. Again, I talk about him like he's a personal friend of mine, but
I definitely see him when he gets like old, like maybe 10, 20 years, like he's going to definitely win an Oscar for something serious, but like he doesn't need to do it until then. Like he can be the superstar now, but like then he's going to have some serious, like grounded role and it's going to be really good. Like with a gray beard.
Oh, like, yeah, I could totally see that.
Or something like The Wrestler. Or something. Yeah, that kind of like an aging athlete doing something.
But I don't think The Rock is ever going to age to where it's like, oh, he's not going to kick ass. I think he's always just going to be like The Rock.
It's fair enough.
He's going to make like a good late career Schwarzenegger film.
Yeah. Like please cast him in the remake of Junior. I want to see him pregnant.
That's going to happen.
This is not the 90s anymore. Like this wouldn't fly anymore.
That was a sentence I didn't expect to hear today.
Like, could you imagine like someone actually remaking Junior now? Like this would be like, no, this is not gonna happen. Like my hands are so soft now. No, I mean, yeah, the Mummy films are shit, apart from the first one.
Yeah, calm down. First one's great.
I still stand by the second one. Blocked. I still stand by the second one, but I like it a lot. I still enjoy it. I still had a good time watching it. I just think it's stupider than I remember.
I don't know, they kind of got a little bit overconfident with their thing that, you know, the special effects would kind of just cover up sort of shortcomings of the script, and they don't.
Would you guys consider the first one to be an uncut gem? Because like I don't know if it's like hidden. I feel like it's very like in the zeitgeist, like mainstream culture,
and it's also making like a really big comeback right now. I find at least on my Twitter feed. I think that's because of like Super Yaki, because they just did the not sponsored. I wish they did sponsor us, but They just did like a launch in February, or it was actually in March, but they called it Fraser February. And they like released a whole shit ton of Brendan Fraser merch. And I have like, I got like 5 pieces from it. I'm wearing the Mummy 1999 It's a Perfect Movie shirt right now. And like, it's sold out like crazy. Like everybody, yeah. Brendan Fraser's making a really big comeback. I want him to be back in things again. Like he's been doing a lot of TV shows recently, but I want him like back.
I mean,
I think he's gonna do it.
He's
gonna have such a big time there's a physical Comic Con, you know he's gonna have like a whole like panel dedicated to him, and it's gonna be like coming out party.
Like 2 or 3 years ago, he came to Fan Expo Toronto, but it was on like a day I couldn't go because I was like moving or something. And it is like the one thing I regret in life is not meeting Brendan Fraser. Like I should have just like said fuck it and gone because he was promoting Doom Patrol.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So,
I mean,
I want him to come back. I missed my chance because I love him so much.
Like,
Fraser, if you're listening to this, you know, we got a big fan ready to meet you, interview you. You know, let's do it.
You don't even believe. So, you know, brace yourself, Brendan. But then I'm just thinking in terms of like whether this is like a hidden sort of gem or whatever. I kind of have a feeling that it kind of is, because like if you think about it, there are certain elements of the first and the second one that are kind of like memes now in certain places of the internet. But like many people will be like, I don't know, it's kind of like I don't know, like an element of culture that's kind of just untethered from where it is. Like people will be like, I don't know where this is from, but it's kind of funny. Because and then it kind of takes a little bit of a Google search to figure out, oh yeah, that's from this film. So I almost feel like the fact that this is like the Brendan Fraser swag and whatever that Super Yaki company is kind of sort of capitalizing on, it's almost like capitalizing on the fact that it's kind of flying slightly under the radar. Like people are aware of it, but people are not aware of it that it's good, for instance, right? So I don't know.
Maybe there's it's no more of like a big thing amongst like my age group.
I mean,
Damn, what are you trying to say? Listen,
whole time he commented about like, oh, I'm like old, and like I was too old when this came out, blah blah blah. So like you can't damn me when he did it the whole episode.
Yo, I guess a retirement home doesn't have the fucking Fraser love, I guess.
Yeah.
Jesus. No, but I suppose this may be the case. But then like, if you look at what say like people on Twitter are into, like this rarely shows up, and people are like, oh, do you remember this? Like people will be a little bit more into other things, I suppose. But then again, maybe that's just a product of who I follow.
Maybe. I've only ever heard love about it. Like even people I know personally, and though to be fair, most of us watched it when we were young. So there's definitely the nostalgia bias that's strong. So
I mean, I'd say the franchise as a whole is an interesting car crash to talk about. The first film is genuinely pleasurable. Although, I don't subscribe to the... Like, I don't have a nostalgic connection. Sorry, I'm a fucking... I'm a boomer, so, you know. I'm gonna have to live with all the Jakub meme. Like, that's happening now. That's where I am. That's the room I'm in. Just like I can see, like, just smirking, like, yeah, fuck yeah, eat it. no, but yeah, it is what it is. I have a feeling that this was, I don't know, even at the time, there were kind of like bigger things that kind of just overshadowed it anyway. Because, like, if you think about 1999, like, the people will just immediately think, oh, The Phantom Menace and The Matrix, that's the big two sort of releases. Because this thing made money, but didn't make this much money, I don't think, no.
Oh, I think all 4 of them, including the reboot with Tom Cruise, they all made around like 400 million.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose like made 400 million 20 years ago. It's quite a lot of million.
Yeah. I should have asked my mom why she likes these movies so much, because I like them because she likes them. Because like I don't think I would have watched these as a child. Because like my childhood with movies was like I watched it because my parents watched it. So like I didn't see Lord of the Rings or Indiana Jones until I was like a teenager because my parents didn't watch them for some reason. Okay. So I wonder like why The Mummy like stuck so much out to my mom. I'm gonna ask her and get back to you guys.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting sort of can you record
that's
this?
That's a 10-minute interview. Yeah, like we did with Raya.
Yeah,
I can try.
Yeah, that'll be good. get some feedback from interested parties. That would be great.
She said she's gonna listen to this. So, Mom, I'm sorry for swearing so much.
Why wouldn't you tell us this before we recorded this entire thing?
I don't think she'll actually listen to it.
I totally love the Mummy films. Please don't hate me. Please don't think. I don't know what you could think because I'm hanging out with kids. Apparently,
I didn't want to cloud your judgment that my mother would be listening to this. I don't think she. I'm. She might. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I could see how this could attract a certain demographic because it has this sort of, I don't know, it kind of feels like an 80s movie made like 20 years later.
Yeah. Well, my parents' reason is they have like this very specific category, this kind of like a complete film, kind of like a full meal. It has action, it has comedy, adventure, a bit of horror, romance. Like it gives you everything you can want from a film. Just you sit down, you have fun, and
it's an all-you-can-eat buffet film.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. Like, you're sick and tired by the end of it, but in a good way. Like, just super full.
This is like an all-you-can-eat buffet. Like you just pay like, I don't know, 15, 20 bucks or whatever, and you're like, I'm on my plate, you have steak, there's rice, there's chocolate, there's prawns, and there's cake. And then I'm like, I've paid for this. I'm gonna eat all of it at once. I don't care. No one's gonna judge me. So yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It's yeah. So I have a feeling we're at the end of our end of the rope in here because now we might as well wrap the baby up. So I don't know. Do you want to go in like final thoughts on the entire franchise, or I don't know. Yeah, let's do this. Alina, final thoughts on the entire Mummy franchise, Scorpion King excluded.
It's definitely a downward trajectory, but I still really, really love it, at least the first two. Like, I realize that I'm very much blinded by childhood nostalgia and the, like, immense love I have for Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz, but, like, I fucking love these movies. I love them. And, like, nothing you can say can convince me otherwise. Even though I like acknowledge now that the second one is not as great as I remember, I still freaking love it. And like these, they're my movies. They're mine. They belong to me. I love them.
Niccolo, your turn.
Yeah, the first Mummy film is one of the very few films from my childhood that actually stood the test of time and didn't turn out to be an absolute pile of garbage. The second one did. I don't have the fondest memories of it now. They've been tainted permanently, but I do think the first one is still an enjoyable, fun romp. It is action adventure. Yeah, everything you want from a blockbuster. It does it well. They set out to do Indiana Jones meets the Mummy film, and it worked. They achieved it gratefully, and they should have stopped there.
Carson?
Yeah, the first one, like, I don't even have any, like, childhood nostalgia towards it, and I think it's an absolute great time. The rest of them, you know, feel free to skip and ignore that they ever existed. But, like, that first one, it's good. It's some of the most witty, fun dialogue I maybe have ever heard. It's just fun. It's pure fun. Do it. Watch it.
I'll put it this way. Based on this conversation, I think I appreciate the first one a little bit more. Although, yeah, I still don't have a nostalgic connection to it, so I cannot relate the way so you, Alina, do. But yeah, I think the first one's definitely the best and definitely worth your time if you haven't seen it yet. And, you know, I suppose if you're a specific, I don't know, frame of mind, or if you, I don't know, haven't grown up with like the 80s movies, then just make you look like at early CGI with a little bit of a suspicious eye, then yeah, it's probably not going to kind of just stand out the way it kind of stands out to me a little bit in terms of like the special effects and how they are dated. The second and the third one are definitely just woof. I don't know. They're a mess, but you know, I don't know. I'm for like $3, I'll probably buy the first one and put it on my shelf. Let's put it this way. So there's that. So anyway, so if you really want to get the three, watch the three films, you can actually do this. So the all three films are available in the UK, at least on Now TV and Sky. So if you know, on Now TV, if you're a regular person, and on Sky, if you're like a posh bastard who has no idea what to do with their money. In the US, I think it's a little bit more complicated because I think you can, correct me if I'm wrong, Carson, the first two you can see on HBO Max and the third one's correct. On TNT. Or
I'm
somewhere
not
else
sure
you
about
can
the,
stream it.
Not sure about the third one, but the first two are on HBO Max, yeah. And you can obviously buy or rent them wherever.
Yeah, so you can buy and rent them, whatever. And in Canada, the first two you can't really stream anywhere.
In Canada, all three of them are on Netflix, and so is Scorpion King.
Oh, is there?
Okay, so good. I'm set.
Okay, good. So they're on Netflix. There you go. Go figure. So you can rent and buy them from all the usual suspects as well. I think all across all countries and all markets. And then I think they all have decent Blu-ray and 4K releases, so they're easily accessible. If you so choose to buy them. So yeah, so that I think this is it for this episode of the Uncut Gems podcast. So I think we can just wrap this up and then let's go around the table and say where we can find you all on social media. Alina, go first.
I'm at Alina Falds on Twitter and Letterboxd, and I do a lot of other things too that you can read in my Twitter bio.
There you go, Niccolo.
You can follow me on Twitter at NickGra97. You can follow me on Letterboxd at Niccolo Grasso. And you can watch my short films and video essays on YouTube and Vimeo at Enjoy the Movies.
And Carson?
You can find me on Twitter at BP_MovieReviews or on Letterboxd, just Carson Tamar.
Okie dokie. And you can find me at Talk About Film, and you can also read all our stuff on Clapper, and you can find all my stuff on flashandfilm.com. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Uncut Gems Pod. So make sure to follow, like, retweet, and our stuff. And also, while you're at it, might as well rate the podcast on Spotify, Apple. It really will help us develop our audience, so that will help. Go do it. You can also send us an email at uncutgemspod@gmail.com. So if you want to sound off about the Mummy movies or the Scorpion King films that we have not seen, apart from Alina. Alina is just a real legend today. She's put in a whole lot of work for this. So this is the way you do it. You can also support the show at ko-fi.com/uncutgemspod. That's ko-fi.com/uncutgemspod. And you can, you know, that way you can help us keep the lights on. So be sure to tune in next week, when we will be doing something a bit different, I think, because until now we have been more or less choosing topics, let's just say randomly, apart from today, because this is a birthday episode. Happy birthday, Alina, by the way.
Thank you.
So apart from today, we've been doing these things more or less randomly and not tying anything to outside events. But next week's episode will, I think if I calculate correctly, we'll fall just ahead of, let's just say, a nerd holiday. If you observe nerd holidays, that will be 4/26, which is Alien Day. So to mark this occasion, we will be doing a double bill of Alien 3 and Pitch Black, which is somehow tied into the Alien legacy. But, you know, we'll talk about that next week. So be sure to check it out. It's probably going to be fun. So with that, I hope you all have a fabulous day, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.